Welcome to Headlines. This is Ari Wasserman sitting in for David Lichtenstein. Today we have a very important and complicated topic, and that is Achdus, unity. Does Achdus mean that we are supposed to embrace Jews who we really don't agree with? For example, those who have views which are antithetical to those of the Torah. We will discuss a number of important issues and questions in this regard, including, is Achdus a halachic imperative or is it a hashkafic concept? What's the definition of Achdus? Does it mean we have to agree with each other? And should we look to have Achdus with groups and movements of Jews who have values against those of the Torah? For example, the progressive movement, which is very aggressive, promoting its agenda. And also, how should we view the Reform and the conservative movements? And can an Orthodox rabbi sit on a committee with the Reform or conservative rabbi? Joining us today, we have a number of very wise and insightful guests. We are going to start out with the great Posek, the renowned Posek and senior lecturer at Yeshivas Or Sameach, Rabbi Dr. Yitzhak Breidowitz, to talk about Hashkafa, Halachas, conceptually when it relates to Achdus. It's a very fascinating conversation with Rabbi Breidowitz. And then we're going to go and speak with Rabbi Moshe Hauer, the renowned Rav and executive vice president of the Orthodox Union, to discuss from his vantage point, how do we have Achdus when dealing with other people, organizations, his experiences both in the United States and also in Eretz Yisrael. We'll talk a little bit politics as well. Then we will speak with Rabbi David Gottlieb. Rabbi Gottlieb was originally a Rav of the largest shul in Baltimore, and then he moved to Eretz Yisrael in 2009, and he's a Rav in Ramat Beit Shemesh, so we'll have a compare and contrast of his experiences in both the United States and Israel and how it relates to Achdus. He's also the director of Tzalash, which is an organization that deals with the Ruchnia side of Chayalim. So we'll talk about that a little bit as well. Rabbi Gottlieb was on a number of months ago, and we made a little bit of a push to give donations to Tzalash. We're going to put the link on the website as well. The donations go for publishing Rav Asher Weiss's Sfarim. They published a number of them, and they continue to do so, publishing the Sfarim and giving them out to the Chayalim, to the soldiers who are actively learning the Sfarim. So please donate as much as you can. This goes for the Chayalim, and it goes for their Ruchnias, and it goes for Limud HaTorah, so many benefits. And then we will speak with Yoni Alon. Yoni is a fascinating conversation there, by the way. He is a non-observant single from Tel Aviv. He's politically on the left. He serves in the IDF. And we're going to have a discussion of getting along with people who you really disagree with politically, religiously, etc. And he's going to talk about a friend of his in the army named Moti, who is very much on the right when it comes to politics. He's very observant, etc., etc. That's going to be a very interesting conversation. And then we will culminate the show with Rabbi Shai Schachter, who is the Rav. He's the Rosh Beis Medrash at the Young Israel of Woodmere. He has a number of other responsibilities as well, and he's been dealing with families of captives. He's had a lot of involvement post October 7th, before that also, and we'll have some very interesting insights from him. What does Achdus mean and what does Achdus not mean? And at the way end of the show, we will have our wrap up, takeaways, and lessons learned. I mentioned before that the question, should we be embracing all Jews across the board or should there be limitations? And in that regard, I want to go to a pasuk in Sefer Vayikra. Parshas Vayikra, it says as follows in Perek Dal, Pasuk Beis, Dabero b'nei Yisrael l'imur nefesh kisechetah. It's talking about the Korban Chatas, the sin offering. And it says the language there, nefesh kisechetah. It doesn't say when somebody, the typical Yushas Ish or whatever. It does say the word nefesh. And in fact, there's a medrash on the pasuk when talking about Klal Yisrael going down to Mitzrayim. It's a medrash in Vayikra on the pasuk, Vayikol nefesh. The same word nefesh, Yatzei Yirech Yaakov Shivim Nafesh. It says as follows in the Medrash that Klal Yisrael are like guf echad, like one body, one organism, v'nefesh achas, and also not only physically but also spiritually one nefesh. And what that means is if one person sins, he is causing damage to everyone. And there's a mashal, a parallel brought of a ship or a boat, a bunch of people in a boat, and one person decides, I want to drill a hole but underneath me, so it shouldn't impact anyone. And everyone says to him, you can't do that, you're negatively impacting all of us. He said, what's in your business? It's underneath me. And the Yismach Yisrael says as follows, the same thing applies here in our pasuk in Parshas Vayikra. Nefesh kisecheta. All of Klal Yisrael. True, it's one. It's one group together, but it's one, united, and accordingly, when one person sins, it causes damage to everyone, just like that person who's knocking a hole in the bottom of the boat. And accordingly, there's an obligation for each person to give hadracha, to give education and direction to everyone else who needs it, so they can avoid sinning. Now, this sounds more like kiruv than achdus, and we'll have to talk about, is there a difference? What is the definition of achdus? What is the definition of kiruv? Because certainly, from October 7th, we have seen a lot of what we would call not kiruv, also kiruv, but achdus, solidarity. We have seen a number of solidarity missions, numerous solidarity missions to Eretz Yisrael. There are professors, doctors, surgeons, businessmen, Jews from numerous occupations and from numerous countries who have come and contributed in any way necessary to anybody necessary. It doesn't matter whether they wore a yarmulke or didn't wear a yarmulke. People came with PhDs and they're picking potatoes, or they were picking potatoes and working farms and tending to other people's businesses, and people cooking nonstop for soldiers. I even have a friend who quit his high-paying job at McKinsey Consulting, the premier consulting firm in the world, to help purchase weapons necessary for the war. And yet, with all of that, and increasingly now, the fissures and cracks between us are back and widening. I want to quote Professor Yisrael Almond, who won the Nobel Prize for his work on conflict. He was actually on headlines a number of weeks ago, maybe a few months ago. And he was quoted as follows, as saying, "The world is against us." And he believes a bigger problem is that we are against ourselves. We say, "Biyachad ninatzeach," together we will win, but we are not biyachad. In that regard, let's go back to Parshas Beshalach, very inyana dioma with Pesach. It says, when Klal Yisrael was fleeing, or they had left Mitzrayim, and the Mitzrayim decided, we're going to go and follow, we're going to go and bring them back, we're going to run after them. And it says in the Pasuk, in Shmos Yudalit, Pasuk Yud, Vehinei Mitzrayim Noseach Reyem, Mitzrayim, they pursued after Klal Yisrael, and Rashi brings the Chazal, Belev Echad Ki Ish Echad, they were with one heart, like one person. Now, what's interesting to note, and this is discussed by the Avnei Nezer from Sukkotchov, he says what's interesting to note in talking about Matan Torah, when Klal Yisrael and Parshas Yisro was by Har Sinai, it says as follows, they were Ki'ish Echad Belev Echad, which is the reverse. When it came to the Mitzrayim, it says Belev Echad, Ki'ish Echad, they had one heart, like one person. When it comes to Klal Yisrael, it says they were like one person, Belev Echad, with one heart. And what's the difference between them? There is a dramatic difference between them. When it comes to Klal Yisrael, yes, we are one. We are one organism, but we do not agree. We don't have a Lev Echad, and accordingly, it's Ki'ish Echad, but only in there, when Matan Torah, they were B'Lev Echad, but typically we are not B'Lev Echad. So when it comes to Klal Yisrael, again, we are Ki'ish Echad, yes, we are all one, but we are not B'Lev Echad typically. On the other hand, when it comes to the non-Jews, they are not Ki'ish Echad, they are not one, they don't come from the same source, they don't come from the same country, the same place, the same locations, the same ideas, but when they have a common agenda, when they happen to agree on something, then they are Belev Echad. And that's their focus, they're Belev Echad, but they're really not Ki'ish Echad. It could be that they have a common interest, it could be being united against Klal Yisrael, against Jews, against the land of Israel, but what's key here is that when it comes to Klal Yisrael, we are fundamentally Ki'ish Echad, but not so Belev Echad. We don't have a lot that really joins us. We have so many views. On the other hand, when it comes to the non-Jews, they are certainly not Ki'ish Echad, but sometimes they do have a common agenda, and then they are Belev Echad. And that's why for them, Belev Echad comes first, and for us, Ki'ish Echad comes first. So in that regard, we'll focus now on Klal Yisrael's Ki'ish Echad, that unity. I want to refer to a book. It's actually a very new book that just came out. It's called War and Redemption. I picked it up being sold outside of a shul. It's right now in bookstores. I understand it got throughout the world right now. It's available. I'll read the cover again, called War and Redemption, the current war and Chevlei Mashiach, based on the teachings of Maran Posek Hador, Harav Moshe Sternbach. So it's a short book, it's not very long, War and Redemption, about the teachings of Rav Moshe Sternbach, on the teachings of Rav Moshe Sternbach. And the last chapter, the very last chapter, chapter 31, he talks about Achdus, and he quotes a Chazal in Medrash Tanchuma that the Jews will only be redeemed when they become one united group. He also quotes a Medrash Bereishis Rabbah, if the Jews have become one unified group, then prepare yourselves for redemption. Having said that, Rav Sternbach continues that the Satan is aware of this, and he therefore makes every effort to create discord, especially at the very end of Galus. Machlokis will delay the coming of Mashiach, and he talks about the importance, the critical importance of having Achdus, having unity, that when people are only caring about himself, themselves, their circle of friends, their group, their community, that is not at all Achdus. It has to be that we are concerned about the klal of Klal Yisrael. Having said that, that is chapter 32. If we go back to the first chapter, which is talks about the war, the current war that we are in, there Rav Sternbach talks about times where you need to stand up, and that having a macha, telling people that they are wrong, protesting, is the right approach, and that is the case even if it's not going to lend to Achdus. And he talks about a terrible occurrence that happened in Tel Aviv on Yom Kippur. It was a public Kol Nidre gathering with the Mechitza, and the left-wing activists were offended by the presence of the Mechitza, and they came and they ruined the davening. They came, they pulled down the Mechitza, and Rav Sternbach says that we need to protest for Hashem's honor. That is a chilul Hashem. It's a terrible chilul Hashem. And when there's a chilul Hashem, we need to stand up and say that is wrong. And in fact, Rav Moshe Sternbach learned that from his Rosh Yeshiva in London, Rav Moshe Yehuda Schneider, who said the same. He said as follows, I'm quoting the book in chapter 1, he would say that when a chilul Hashem occurs, Hashem expects us to protest, and such protests mitigate the trait of judgment aroused by the original chilul Hashem. He says in the footnote, by not protesting, the righteous bear joint responsibility for the sins of the wicked. We cannot simply say, this is what he says, we cannot simply say it doesn't affect us, that's what they're doing, that's not what our problem. He says the tumah created by such actions has a supernatural effect on the whole Jewish nation. So we see here, one chapter, Achdus, critical, but in another chapter, if there's a chilul Hashem, we need to protest. So there seems to be a little bit of, I wouldn't call it a stira, but there's somewhat of a friction between these two things. When do we have Achdus, and when do we have to stand up and say that is unacceptable, even at the expense of Achdus? And Amir Tzashem, this is something that we'll hopefully cover in this show. That is simply an example of the complexity of our topic, the importance of Achdus on the one hand, but it's not going to be applicable all the time. There are going to be times that we're going to say that there are values of the Torah that are more important than Achdus. Before we go to our guest, let's hear the riddle of the week. The riddle of the week relates to our topic of Achdus. There are times in Halacha that we give priorities, not Jews over non-Jews, but even Orthodox Jews, Shomrei Torah Mitzvahs over non-Shomrei Torah Mitzvahs. I'll give you an example. There's a pasuk that says, V'chisim karo memkar lamitach, etc. When you're selling something, when you're buying something. And the word here is la'amisecha, and the drush of Chazal is, what's amisecha? La'am she'itcha b'mitzvah, somebody who is together with you in mitzvahs. In other words, you give a priority when you're buying and selling, when you're doing business. It's also, we learn from this, when you're hiring an employee, the preference should be given to somebody who is together with you in mitzvahs, that is somebody who is observant. And the question is, where do we hear other examples? Where do we see other examples in Halacha that a preference is given to somebody who is observant, somebody who is am she'itcha b'mitzvahs over other people? And we can add an additional question, does that shed any light on Achdus? When does Achdus apply? When does Achdus not apply? Or these specific examples in Halacha, and it applies only in those cases, but it does not shed light on the more the general concept of Achdus, that is something that we should have for all Jews, regardless of their being Am She'itcha B'mitzvahs or not.
If you want to leave a message by phone or dial in by phone to listen, in America, our number is 732-806-8700. In England, it's 44-33-011-70250. In Eretz Yisrael, it's 02-372-0304.
And now let's go and hear from our guests. Joining us now is Rabbi Yitzhak Breidowitz. Rabbi Breidowitz is a world-renowned posek and also somebody who personifies being a real Ohev Yisrael. He loves every Jew, and that's why I wanted him desperately on this show, because we need a tremendous posek and also somebody who's an Ohev Yisrael, because this is a difficult topic, talking about unity and disunity. He is also, Rabbi Breidowitz is also a senior lecturer at Or Sameach and is sought after to address so many challenging contemporary issues that we are grappling with nowadays in Klal Yisrael. Rabbi Breidowitz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rabbi. It's always a great pleasure and honor to be with you. I hope one day to be zocha to the kind words that you said.
You are, and I had to trim them down because, chetzi shevach b'fanav. I think that was only shlish ravia. But in any case, Rabbi Breidowitz, I need to admit to you, I am confused about our topic. I don't have any agendas, things getting on and saying we need achdus or saying we don't need achdus, chas v'shalom. I'm simply confused because I hear a lot about Achdus and I definitely try to implement it, but I am having a difficult time understanding what it means, what's the definition, and when does it apply? For example, almost any time, no, maybe that's an exaggeration, but sometimes I hear a Jewish person say something. For example, Senator Chuck Schumer, who used to be called the Ohev Yisrael, and more recently has come out negative against the state of Israel. And my question is, well, Achdus, do I have to embrace him nonetheless? Or recently I heard a Reform rabbi make comments against the state of Israel. And the question is, Achdus, how should I react? Should I still embrace this individual? I happen to disagree with this individual. So what does Achdus require for me? So why don't we start out with really a very fundamental question. Achdus, from the word echad, one, is this a halachic imperative? Is this a hashkafic concept or something else? What's the source for Achdus in this? Is this a requirement for each and every Jew?
Yeah, so I first want to start off with some hashgafic background, and then I'll try to move to definitive halachic statements. Since October 7, our world has changed a lot. We've been living in a state of crisis, and our prayers are with the families that have lost people and the chatufim, the prisoners, and even those who, Baruch Hashem, did not directly suffer. We're living in fear and anxiety. Ma yulad hayom, what's going to happen today? What's going to happen tomorrow? And it's been a time of great, great difficulty. But one of the silver linings to this dark cloud has been a renewed commitment in times of crisis that we do stand together. I think I see an achdus between religious and secular and different parts of the religious community that we had not seen for a very long time. To quote Benjamin Franklin, we all have to hang together, otherwise we will surely hang separately. And I think we've seen that, we felt that. Unfortunately, you can get used to anything. So as time goes on, some of this achdus is disintegrating. But I think fundamentally, I'd like to share with you a thought from the Kutzker Rebbe that's quite beautiful. It says the Navi Zechariah describes what a Jew should strive for. And the Navi Zechariah says, Ha'emes v'ha'shalom ehavu. One must love peace, and one must love truth. The Kutzker Rebbe points out that in many ways, this is often a contradiction. It's easy to love peace if you don't care about truth, and it's easy to care about truth if you don't love peace. Because here it is. Different people have different views on many, many things. Some of them are within the purview of halacha. Some of them are outside the purview of halacha. Now, there are two different personality types and how I relate to that kind of discrepancy or that diversity. I could be a man of peace, a man of big tents. I'm okay, you're okay. I love every Jew. But the problem is that sometimes I lack a moral clarity, I lack halakhic clarity, and at that point, I don't stand for anything. So it's easy to be a lover of humanity if there's nothing that you stand for. Conversely, there's another personality type, we'll call him the true believer, as Eric Hoffer called him, or we'll call him a kanoi, who stands for the values of the Torah, but as a result, can exhibit no sense of tolerance or acceptance towards those who don't stand by the standards that he's espousing. So which is it? Are we condemned to this eternal dichotomy, this eternal contradiction? I'm either a lover of peace or a lover of truth? Well, the Navi is telling me no. The Navi says, Ha'emes v'ha'shalim e'avu. You must love truth, you must love peace. Loving truth means I don't compromise my values. Loving truth means I stand for clarity. I don't simply say, I'm okay, you're okay. I don't go with a moral relativism, whether it be gay marriage or abortion on demand or whatever it would be. I represent what the Torah teaches. But at the same time, I don't have to delegitimate other people. I don't have to demonize other people. I don't have to look at them as fundamentally bad. I might consider them to be misguided. But at least I can have a dialogue with them. I can have a conversation with them. And if indeed I need to keep my distance, and we'll probably touch upon that a little later, I can still do so without necessarily considering them to be evil or rishoyim. There are maybe misguided people that I need to disassociate for my own protection and the protection of my family, but it doesn't have to take the form of demonization. I've mentioned a number of other places, a pasuk from Mishle that I think is such a fundamental pasuk that people should put it on their refrigerator door. Kamayim haponim elponim, kein lev ha'adam li'adam. As water reflects the face that you show the water, so too the heart of man reflects that which is shown. The Vilna Gaon explains, when I look down at a reflecting pool of water, whatever face I show the water will be the face that I see back. I smile at that water, I will see a smiling face. I frown at that water, I will see a frowning, angry face. So too, a human being will reflect back to me that which I show that human being. If I show that human being decency, respect, legitimation for the good that exists within him, the idea of Tzelem Elokim, that within that person there is the image of God, then that person will also see the beauty of what it is that I'm trying to stand for and I'm trying to represent.
A quick question on the Pasuk in Zechariah, is there validity, is there significance to the fact that Emes comes before Shalom?
So this is an interesting point. On one hand, it's a little bit of a problem. On one hand, you know, you're right. Your diuk is good.
But you need something first.
Well, let me tell you the counter svara. So your svara is MS takes priority over Shalom. Yeah. But I heard a word, I believe it may have been from Rav Nissen Alpert, I don't want to say 100%, who is the great beloved Talmud of Rav Moshe Feinstein, that he pointed out a chazal. It says, Chaisamai shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Emes. Emes is the seal of God. Shalom is the name of God. And Rav Nissen Alpert said, I believe, and as Alpert says, that a name is more closer to your essential identity than your signet ring. So you have a diak from the Pasuk, Hachinami, but Rav Nissen wanted to say that Shalom in some ways is even higher. No, there's a Tana Deve Elio. I want to get back to that. Tana Deve Elio says the following. Eliyahu HaNavi quotes HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Shnei Devarim Ani Ayev, there are two things that I love, Bi'ava Gemura. One is my Torah and one is Am Yisrael. So the person had the chutzpah to ask Eliyahu HaNavi, what does God love more? Torah, Am Yisrael, Ava Gemura. And Eliyahu HaNavi initially didn't want to say, but the questioner was persistent. And the answer was, Am Yisrael, my nation. The exact implications of that statement are maybe beyond us, but in a very, very deep way, I think it supports what I believe Rav Nissen Alpert said, that Shalom, I mean, it's like asking, you know, what's more important, your heart or your brain? I mean, obviously you need both to be alive, but in some sense of hierarchy, the Shalom is the highest value. Now, I just want to point out, based on the Kamayim Aponim Aponim, that if I look at another person, another Jew, and all I see are their flaws. I see their chesronos. I see their inadequacies. I see their failures. They're going to look at me the same way. I should strive to train myself to see the good. But that doesn't mean to adopt everything. It doesn't mean moral relativism. It doesn't mean ethical subjectivity. It does not mean compromise with halach. This is very difficult to navigate. I will admit to you that, because, you know, we live in a world where so many positions are against halach. But, you know, when I remember Gedolei Yisrael, I can't say I know many, many Gedolei Yisrael, but I think of Rav Moshe Feinstein, I think about Rav Ruderman, my Rosh Hashiva, I think of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. More recent examples, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And other Gedolim too. I don't want to mention every different people because I don't want to exclude anybody. But the one thing I notice is that somehow in their lives, they were able to balance emes and shalom. That there were times that they had to take difficult stances and they had to articulate. The truth is, I'll mention Rav Shach. Rav Shach is a primary example. And really, this was a caricature by the secular press in which, you know, Rav Shach would often come out very, 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 very strong, condemning different behaviors, condemning different approaches that were against the Torah, because as a leader of the yeshiva community in Eretz Yisrael, he had an achrayas to point out what was right and what was emes and what was sheker. But fewer people know that on a one-to-one individual basis, Rav Shach was the kindest, sweetest, gentlest man to not only religious Zionists, let's say, but to totally non-religious people, chilonim. He made them feel welcome. He tried to encourage them. He tried to build them up in various ways. He was an ish shalom, even though for various purposes, he sometimes had to be.
Had to take a stance. So when it comes to the halachic aspect.
The halachic aspect here. I mean, the halachic aspect, as you might expect, is not always totally cut and dry. On one hand, there is a mitzvah, the ahavta l'reyecha kamecha, that I should love at least my fellow Jew the way I love myself, an unconditional love. On the other hand, the argument's going to be that the word reyecha does not just mean every Jew or every person, but reyecha, someone that shares a commonality with you in Torah and mitzvahs. So if somebody wanted to look, is it mutter, are there heterim to have hatred or distance to a non-religious Jew, one could make the argument of Rasha, etc. It's not Reyecha, it's not Ochicha, the Torah of a mitzvah. So, once again, there is such an argument, but I would strongly suggest that is even as a matter of halacha, that by and large should not apply today. And my source is not some modern Orthodox rabbi, open orthodoxy in New York. My source is the Chazon Ish, who I believe was not, you know, of left-wing orthodoxy. And the Chazon Ish writes that many of the strictures in Chazal about apikorsim and minim and kofrim and rishaim do not fully apply today, because they applied in a time when the Hashgacha of Hashem was open and revealed and obvious. And if I chose not to follow God's path, I was rebelliously acting in lahachis, in spite. Today, number one, the presence of Hashem is concealed in a lot of ways. And the majority of Jews, now you can't really call a person a renegade if he's simply following what Lazareno, a majority of Jews are doing. So the Chazon Ish does not use the word. People often paraphrase the Chazon Ish by calling it everyone today is a tinoik shenishba, like the baby that was kidnapped. The Chazon Ish technically does not use that language, but it's a paraphrase of the Chazon Ish. But the Chazon Ish's point was that most, I'm not saying there's no exceptions to it, maybe we'll explore that, but most non-religious Jews today, even if they don't keep Shabbos, even if they're not Isaac in such important mitzvahs, are not evil, they're not rebellious, they're not people who don't want to identify as Jews. And as a result, whatever heterim one would have to hate the Russia would not apply to a non-religious Jew today who does not fall under the category of Russia. Moreover, it is said, in order to halachically be a Russia, it has to be a person to whom proper tochacha, proper musar was given, and they didn't accept it. Either today, either we didn't give the tochacha, or if we did, we did a lousy job, as the Gemara itself already comments, that the reason why some people are not mekabel tochacha is because we don't always know how to give tochacha. And I know from my own personal experience in Or Sameach how misplaced tochacha, maybe let's talk for another show, misplaced tochacha can often be totally destructive.
Absolutely. So, Rabbi Breitowitz, it seems that we're having a category of achdus, echad, and we could include v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, or maybe not. Reya, maybe Am Sheitcha B'Mitzvahs, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh. Maybe we'll put that as the top category. And we have a different category that people who maybe you could hate or give tochacha. And we're saying that based on the Chazon Ish, a lot would not fit in that bottom category of putting them down, giving them tochacha. But it seems maybe we have a middle category between those two extremes. Would we maybe put people who have progressive values, or there are Reformed and conservative Jews? I'm not saying all of them, but there are those that are actively destructive to our beliefs and our practices, and there is a conflict there. Would we still put them in the top category of achdus, unconditional love, being accepting, or would they maybe go into the not flesh, not milchik, but the parv category in the middle?
So here is the thing. There are really two aspects here. In terms of their own personal violations of the Torah and their own perverse hashkafot, the Chazon Ish's point would apply equally to them that, you know, they're not at fault. They've been brainwashed by the progressive culture that's out there, whether it's woke culture or whatever it would be. So once again, I can't say that they're evil, bad people. On the other hand, even if we say as personal individuals, they are not, you know, evil, rishaim, mean-spirited people, they are engaged in, from our perspective, destructive activities. I mean, Lamashal, you can have a person, I don't want to say something that's too, negative, but a person might have even diminished mental capacity, but if they're brandishing a weapon, something has to be done. So you're really dealing with two different issues. The issue is not castigating people. It's not insulting people. It's not humiliating people, even people of that ilk. But there does need to be a sense of clarity as to what is the Torah's position. Now, at that point, it becomes a tactical decision. What is the best way to advance the agenda of Torah and Judaism when it meets the onslaught of forces, albeit even good intention? I am willing to even concede benign intentionality in the other side, but there's Lamaisa, they're doing things that are, from our perspective, perverse. So here I would just say that even pragmatically, some type of love is going to be more effective. Mayim upon him. In other words, when you kind of meet it with demonstrations, you meet it with violence, you meet it with name calling, you meet it with insult, you're not advancing your cause. Just from the most narrow perspective, I want to achieve a certain agenda. So I don't see, again, I mean, different rabbis have taken different positions, including Gedolim, so it's not for me to be machria in this. But again, I'm following, let's say, the Mahalach, I think, that Rav Chaim Kanevsky, Zatzal, supported, Rav Steinman supported, in which the concept is that you teach the Torah, you convey the values of the Torah, but you don't necessarily do so by demonstrations, by violence, by name-calling.
Let's talk about a situation. I can understand if conservative, Reformed, or whatever it is, and they're antithetical to Torah, but they're living in their realm. We're living in our realm, and we can have mutual respect for one another. But how about when their realm enters our realm? And I'll give you some examples. Maybe very technical, small example. We had a show once, and I had the privilege of having you on, talking about the LGBT, and we had the West Orange Bake Shop in New Jersey, and I'll put another plug that everyone should go and buy by the West Orange Bake Shop. Subsequent to that show, I had the privilege of tasting some of their goods, and they're fantastic. And they got an order. They received an order from a conservative synagogue. Can we have a rainbow cake? And we want to serve it on Shabbos for a kiddush. So that's an example of their values coming into our realm. Or we have the women of the wall davening at the Kosel, davening there, having a safer Torah, women leaning from the Torah. Or it could be somebody that says, I want you to use my pronouns, and it was originally a female, and now wants you to call that individual as a male. So these are examples of when they're coming into our chatzer and forcing their beliefs that are antithetical to Torah upon us. How do we deal with a situation like that? We have to take a stand.
Yeah. Well, I think there is room for a lot of debate on those particular subjects. My own inclination would try to be accommodating to a certain degree, even in those situations. So, for example, if there could be a designated place, maybe not mamash by the Kotel, but to the side or whatever it would be, let them do what they do. And I certainly would not meet it with protest. Mimanovshach, I would not go with that mahalach and the like. And I also think that even when we have to take principled stance, if we do it without denigration and invective, I think there can be mutual respect. In fact, one of my arguments sometimes against the secular values that are being asserted against us is that they seem to look at respect and tolerance as a one-way street. It's always the religious has to acknowledge us. Okay, but why don't you acknowledge the religious? Meaning to say, I think there needs to be a mutual respect. Now, I understand that that's a loaded term because in a sense, a religious person by definition is almost going to be intolerant because we believe in a single truth. We don't believe in all truths being equal or all truths being true, but at least on an operational level, I think we can show a respect, a tolerance. We're not going to interfere with them if they respect us.
Yeah, so let's try to come full circle based on that statement of having the combination, the best of the best. If we can get a definition of Achdus, that I don't know if it's possible because there's so many situations, but is there a definition of Achdus that when something comes up, I can say, Ha'emes, Vashalem, Ehavu, how do I think about this? How can I address this issue? How should I feel internally when there's something that I disagree with, but I still want to adhere to the mandate of Achdus?
So it really breaks down into two different situations. For example, there is Achdus when all sides are within the framework of Torah, and then Achdus when... So within the framework of Torah, I think we have to have the humility to understand that within Klal Yisrael, there are different Mesoros and different traditions. So for example, if someone comes from a Torah im Derech Eretz background, and they believe that advanced secular studies is consistent with a Torah lifestyle, then if my shita is not that way and my Messiah is not that way and I'm not going to raise my children that way, that doesn't mean I should denigrate what they stand for. They have a Messiah within Klal Yisrael that this is a Hanhaga and vice versa as well. I think the same thing is true for issues regarding Zionism, service in the army. I don't think these should automatically be portrayed as Torah and anti-Torah perspectives. I think these are legitimate different deos and tashkafos within Klal Yisrael. And Achdus means that just because I have different shitos doesn't mean I delegitimate or demonize other things that have a Masaira, a Gushpanka, a seal of approval by Gedolei Yisrael. That's point number one. This is why Yiddishkeit is based on Shvatim. You know, it's not enough that you're a Jew. There are different Shvatim because every Shevet had a different Derech and Mahalech in Avodas Hashem. And what God is saying is unity is not conformity. It is not sameness. It is bringing together diverse elements. Now, this HaTeinach, this is going to work when you're talking about people have different deos within the panorama of Torah Mesorah. Now, when you're dealing with Achdus, when people are coming in from outside of that Mesorah, and at that point, there's no way you can legitimate what they stand for, and indeed there are going to be lines. God forbid, I'm not suggesting there are no lines. So there, the Achdus, I think, takes another form in which you do have to stand up for the MS. You do have to demarcate your position, but you can still see that there's a Dovar Tov. I mean, if you read Chazal all the time, you know, Yeravam ben Nevat, you know, had one, you know, one good thing, you know, Dovar Tov, Achav, people who are Rishayim, but the Navi goes out of his way, or Chazal go out of their way to say, Yan nimtza bei davar tov, there's something good there. You know, years ago, when I first began teach, almost 50 years ago, I was giving a shir to people who were not religious at all. And one woman went over to me after the shir. I don't remember her question, but she prefaced her shir by saying, I'm not as religious as you, but something. So I said to her, well, why do you say you're not as religious as me? You know, maybe I know more about Shabbos and Kashrus than you, but maybe you honor your parents better than I do. Maybe you control your anger better than I do. That's also religious. I can look at a person and say, you know, I really admire your kindness. I admire your generosity. I admire, you know, the way you talk to your children. You know, it doesn't have to be an all or nothing thing. And most people are not l'hachastik erishoyim, as the Chazon Ish pointed out. And I think achdus can actually bring people much closer to Torah. The Chasam Sofer says, when it says by Aaron HaKohen, Oev Shalom v'roidev Shalom, Oev Asabriyais u'mikarvan l'tayra, says the Chasam Sofer, these are not two different things. He loves people and he brought them to Torah. It's one thing. Because of the love that he showed them, he brought them to Torah. You know, I want to tell you a quick story with Rav Chaim Eiser. That Rav Chaim Eiser was, of course, the Gadol Hador, and during the early, very early years of the war, he handled millions and millions of dollars and other currencies for tzedakah, for relief. And the head of Hayas, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, was a Dr. Schmidt from Cincinnati, a physician who was handling, and he had to talk to Rav Chaim Eiser. He was not a Shomer Shabbos. He was, and in the middle, Rav Chaim Eiser took his hand and said, "Do you mind if I call you Reb Shmuel? Because, you know, I want to give you a title of honor." And Dr. Schmidt started crying because he said, "Rabbi, I don't even keep Shabbos. I mean, you know, a rabbi like you shouldn't call me anything special. I'm a doctor. You can call me because I'm a doctor, but I'm not a Reb." So Rabbi Chaim Eiser said, "Why do you say that about yourself? You're a person who's risking his life to come to a war zone to help Jews. Do you think you're not choshev in God's eyes? Do you think that what you're doing doesn't make you beloved by God?" And he says, "You're a Reb Shmuel." And Dr. Schmidt wrote his biography later that he said he left Rabbi Chaim Eiser's office. He put on tefillin that day. He became a Shomer Shabbos. Rabbi Chaim Eiser didn't criticize him. Rabbi Chaim Eiser pointed out what was good in him. And from that came everything else. Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, visited Eretz Yisrael only once in his life. And he was zocheh to meet Rav Kook. Now, obviously, the Drachim of Machshava were not the same at all. But he told one story about Rav Kook that impressed him. Rav Kook went once to visit a totally anti-religious kibbutz, not just non-religious, Shomer HaTzair, communist. And Rav Kook wanted to talk to him. They were mamish. They didn't even want him. They didn't invite him. They said, "We don't want you to come." But he came and he asked them, just to give you an example, he asked them, "Could we just have a minyan Friday night?" They said, "No." So he sat in the dining room. The food is treif. They're doing sewing there. They're doing Mechilul Shabbos Barabim. And he sat there. You know, he had his own wine and bread. He had challah. He schmoozed with the people. And the same thing, lunch. They didn't give him a minyan. They didn't give him anything. And all he did was talk to them and, you know, see how they're doing. At the end of Shabbos, he said, "It was a great honor for me to spend Saturday with you. I hope the next time I come, we'll be able to break bread together." So he left. That night, the head of the kibbutz said, "We're koshering the kitchen."
Wow.
"We're koshering the kitchen because we want the Rav to be able to eat with us next time." You know, these are, you know, maybe they're going to call me Pollyanna or whatever it would be, but these are the stories that I think change the world. This changes the world. People are changed when a representative of Torah can see the good in them. So that's a different type of achdus, meaning the achdus vis-a-vis other shitas of Torah requires the humility to understand that what's right for me is not necessarily universal. There are different drachim, like shvatim, vis-a-vis things that are outside of Torah. I think it comes to try to identify what Chassidus calls the pintaliyid inside. And that can have all sorts of transformative effects.
Right. Rabbi Breit, it's incredibly well said. That's an incredible framework that we can think through and apply. So thank you so much for giving that over to us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bezras Hashem, we should all be zaycha. You know, Purim was all about, we were mefuzar u'mefurad bein ha'amim. We were separated. And Esther's response was, "Lech kenais es kol ha'yehudim." Let's come together. When we come together, there's no end to what Klal Yisrael could accomplish.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Rabbi Breitowitz. Thank you. Joining us now is Rabbi Moshe Hauer. Rabbi Hauer is the Executive Vice President of the Orthodox Union. Prior thereto, he was the highly regarded rabbi of Congregation B'nai Jacob Shari Zion in Baltimore for over 26 years. Rabbi Hauer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Ravari, for the opportunity.
It's a pleasure to have you. If we could start conceptually, and then we'll get a little bit more practical. So on a conceptual level, because I know you deal with these issues constantly as the outward face of one of the, if not the primary Orthodox organization, not only in the United States, but worldwide. Does being united, and maybe we'll define that as having achdus, or maybe we won't define it, I'll leave that to you. Does being united mean that we need to agree with one another? And if we don't agree, are we really united?
Certainly. Certainly, being united does not require that everybody agrees. That's the nature of the way things are. There is an ideal which existed when Klal Yisrael was able to be truly united, which when they were able to have Torah achas, as Chazal say, and that was when the differences of opinion had a forum for resolution upon which everybody would act. When there was a single Sanhedrin, now the Rambam describes beautifully the process when there was a question which came up in some remote corner, and the local Sanhedrin didn't have a masorah about the question. They would move it up the channel until it came to either a Besdin that had dealt with it previously, or if it had not been dealt with, it went straight to the Sanhedrin. It went all the way up to the Sanhedrin HaGadol. They would decide, and then the decision would radiate outwards to everywhere else. And then you had a central decision-making body that defined what Torah was, what Torah stood for the Jewish people. And that's the ultimate. It's the ultimate achdus. It's written in many forms. The Maharal writes about it a great deal. The idea that when there's a pizur, when there's a scattering in the Jewish people, it comes as well with a pizur, a scattering of Torah. So you don't find Mishnah Berurah, Halacha Berurah, B'makom Echad. Again, our goal here is not to be philosophical in a sense, but practical. But that practicality is indeed part of galus. There's dispersion that we don't have one absolute central authority, and we are to some degree divided. However, at the same time, the state of Golus does not require absolutely that we're at each other's throats. It does mean that we are decentralized, but it does mean that we're at each other's throats. And even then, in the Sanhedrin, they decided to practically move ahead, even if they saw things differently, The biggest deal and the most fundamental piece of it is that we have an argument in principle that is there within a context of an ironclad commitment to one another. There are lots of arguments that can exist between people who are very, very committed to each other. It can happen in families. It can happen in businesses. It can happen in communities. Of course, people see things differently. And yes, we often don't have a single resolution mechanism. But how strong is the commitment to be together, to stay together, to say, Anoshim Achim Anachnu, we are brothers and sisters, we are in it for the long haul? And that's the thing that has to be emphasized. It has to be a cardinal principle, an unshakable value of our community.
So effectively, it's Eilu ve'Eilu divrei Elokim Chaim. You have your opinion, I have my opinion, and I'm going to respect your opinion. You should respect my opinion. But I want to delve a little bit deeper. That to me makes sense when we have opinions that don't necessarily conflict. For example, he wears a white yarmulke, I wear a black yarmulke, or the reverse. And it's his business what he wears, and it's my business what I wear, and it doesn't disturb me what he wears, and it shouldn't disturb him what I wear. Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim Chaim. But I want to quote from an article that you wrote recently. It's called True Unity. And it says as follows, ideological divisions can tear us apart, etc. And then it continues, our ideological divisions, however sharp, must never overwhelm the love and commitment we viscerally feel for each other and our commitment to a shared destiny, which is really what you're saying right now. But when we get past the ideological divisions, there are practical consequences, there are practical ramifications to those ideological divides, that machlokas on the ideological level. Today, the most prominent in Israel, which we don't have to talk about, it's just an example I'm giving, is you need to serve in the army. And the response is over my dead body. So that's an ideological, literally over my dead body. So that's an ideological machlokas, but it has very practical consequences. So how do we deal with that? It's not just ideological, but the practical consequences of the ideological machlokas.
Like any mature partnership, like a family where one of them says, I think we should move to Har Nof, and the other one says, we should move to Beit Vegan. And they're very different. And you can't say Eilu ve'Eilu divrei Elokim Chaim because the family's going to live under one roof. And so what are they going to do? They're going to say, we are a family. We're going to live in one place. And there are arguments this way. There are arguments that way. We're going to sit down together. We're going to make a decision. The decision won't reflect necessarily everybody's priorities. We're going to do the best we can. And then we're going to live with it because we are absolutely committed to stay together as a family. And it's not worth, as important it is, as it is for me to be in Bayit Vegan versus Harnof, it's even more important that I should live with you. And it's that kind of just like basic maturity that we need. I know this might sound a little bit condescending or patronizing and so on and so forth. It's a little bit of like wariness spelled with W-E-A-R, a little bit of tiredness of that we're just not prioritizing this. It's too easy for us to just drop the other and get away from each other and not have them as part of the calculus because they don't think the same way. And that comes at a cost, comes at a very big cost.
I think that's an excellent answer, Rabbi Howard. Not that you need my approbation on your response, but I think that really makes a lot of sense. It does take a certain amount of maturity to come to the table. Unfortunately, nowadays, we even see people not even coming to the table with the desire to breach the gap. So I do appreciate that response. I'd love to know on a personal level, as the executive vice president of the OU, you are the outward face of the OU. I would imagine that you experience seeing this conflict or needing to balance unity with taking a stand against what you view as wrong. So how do you personally balance that conflict, which often does occur between, on the one hand, Shalom and MS?
So this is going to be a repetitive interview. It's going to be the same thing. I'm going to be saying the same thing, you know, over again, which is that the way we balance it, we're absolutely committed to MS, to truth, to principle, to being firm and serious about principle. But to do it in a framework of a commitment as well to Avas Yisrael, a commitment to Shalom, a recognition that one of the core principles that we function with is that we need everybody to be part of the future of the Jewish people. And I often tell people that Orthodox Judaism has, you know, you can always decide what the principles are. Famous Gemara in Makkos, which Habakkuk v'Hamidon, you know, everybody had their distilled it down to principles. So here is a contemporary way of describing it on two different axes. Number one is, I would say sometimes that it's two principles, one of which the world outside knows us for and is completely befuddled by, and the other one the world outside doesn't realize. And the one is that we believe in the eternal and immutable truth of the Torah Hashem. The Torah, lo tehi muchlefes, lo yachal lifakil, v'lo yomir doso, and however you want to express it, the core principle that Torah is eternal truths. They don't change. Society's values change. Society's mores change. The Torah doesn't change. And everybody knows us as that, right? We're Orthodox. We're stiff. We won't change. We won't go with the times. Society decided something is okay. We're still stuck in that. It's not okay. And vice versa. So everybody knows us that way. They also, but there's a second principle. And the second principle is that a Jew is always a Jew. Yisrael aval pishachata, Yisrael hu. And that our commitment to another Jew, to our fellow Jew, is also eternal and immutable. Yes, and I know Makoros, so there could be a person who goes, you know, completely off and is a kofar and so on and so forth. But remember that Chazal of Yisrael Aval Pishachata Yisrael, and know the vast amount of material that we have on the sad situation when people make decisions out of ignorance rather than out of defiance, which includes many of the Jews, you know, around us. And just remember that immutable thing. And by the way, certainly, you know, I held myself back from responding to it, but like the white yarmulke and the black yarmulke, that's like Yisrael afal pishachavash kipah shelo mehatzeva shelanu Yisrael. And you know, come on, right? So like, where is that value going to be expressed? And it's insufficiently known, and we have to take that on ourselves. Like, why doesn't the world realize that we are just absolutely committed to be in permanent connection and relationship to every other Jew? And maybe the answer is because even amongst us Orthodox people, we don't demonstrate that commitment nearly enough. So therefore, they can't imagine that it would be true about people who are beyond that. So that's a value which we have to. And Ravari, if you'll give me another minute, not in answering of a question, but Klal Yisrael is in a very difficult time right now. Very, very difficult. And it all started on October 7th, on Simchas Torah in Eretz Yisrael, Shmini Atzeres and Chutz La'aretz. Did it? Is that when it started? So you know what we reflect sometimes is that if somebody just saw someone on Simchas Torah, ashen-faced, someone in America saw someone and they looked like a terrible tragedy had happened, and they said, "Is everything okay?" I said, "No, it's not okay. What happened?" He says, "You didn't hear what happened in Eretz Yisrael." What would be the first thing that went through a person's mind was that there was a civil war between Jews and Eretz Yisrael. What would have, the first thing would have went through people's mind was that maybe on the streets of Tel Aviv, there was a Simchas Torah celebration with a mechitza and there was a big fight, or whatever else it is. And whoever started the fight, I'm choosing just one example, but you know, the fight could easily have started both ways.
And that did happen on Yom Kippur. That did happen on Yom Kippur.
Correct. And you know, coming out of this was a period of terrible, terrible internal division in the Jewish people, and it led, we must believe, in spiritual ways. The devaluation of Shalom Beinenu can only lead to negative things with Shalom from the outside, and then obviously in practical ways, you know, when an enemy sees us not having our act together, not being together, maybe undermining the integrity of service in the army and not being willing to serve and who knows what, and all of these different things, which again, I don't hold one side responsible. I hold everybody. I think every side contributed to an atmosphere of fracture. So like, where's our cheshbon nefesh? Where's our fixing it? It has to be elevated. We have to, this achdus thing is not just like a nice thing for a kumzitz or for Erev Tisha B'Av or something like that. It's a core issue and it's surfacing again. Painfully, but very visibly, and so we have work to do.
Yeah, it even goes worse than that. Even goes more than that. Hamas tries to leverage the disunity that we have, and that's why they elongate everything all the negotiations
every
over
negotiation.
The. Yeah. Because the longer they wait, the more fractured we become, the more protests there are, and they know that time is our worst enemy. And they very much try to play on to that very effectively, and we fail greatly in that area. But we just want to come back with another question, and it relates to politics in Israel. I know there was a Jerusalem Post article about your meeting with Reform Jews and the Reform movement and the conservative movement. And I know that's a whole discussion and a major issue that comes up, especially meeting the Orthodox Union. And especially even before that, as a Rav of a shul, these issues do come up. I want to talk about one specific issue that was talked about in the Jerusalem Post, and that was meeting with the prior government headed by Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett. And it was a discussion of, and I'll quote what they quoted from you, the issue of the Jewish state as a source of strong and welcoming identities to American Jews across the board should be an issue of common cause. And my specific question is, certain politicians in Israel have views that are antithetical to the Torah, maybe not all their views, but certainly some of the views. And if we can focus specifically on this issue, like, who is a Jew and Jewish identity? How do we have commonality of conversation on a specific issue like that when we're coming from such diametrically opposed views of we can't even define who is a Jew the same way?
The issue of who is a Jew and Jewish identity, on the one hand, is the clearest issue in halacha, which is that it's a person who is born of a Jewish mother or who has converted according to halacha. And conversion according to halacha would seem to require, as in its paradigm, nasa v'nishma, as it was at Har Sinai, an acceptance of mitzvahs as part of that process. It is something which is deeply, deeply confused inside and out by conflicting standards and practices when it comes to what the benchmark of Kabbalah's mitzvahs is. And, you know, this has been an issue which has been very complicated for Klal Yisrael for a good 150 years, in a sense, maybe for 3,300 and something years, but, you know, since the days of Gam Erev Rav Ola Itam, but certainly in its current iteration for this period of time, and it's difficult. And then there's, of course, the terrible act of division, which was committed by the non-Orthodox community when they decided to say that somebody whose father was Jewish and mother wasn't Jewish is also going to be considered to be a Jew. And what's more necessary for the unity of the Jewish people than a definition of who's part of the Jewish people? And to just play with it and change it without regard for its consequences for others within the Jewish community is really it's hard to find a more divisive act. And yet now we find ourselves to some degree on the defensive, as if we are dividing by holding a line as to, okay, Jew. So, you know, who's a Jew, who's an Israeli? This is an ongoing problem of being able to try and to solve it and to do it in a way which will stand well for the future integrity of the Jewish state. And at the same time, we need to recognize, the ramifications, the lay of the land of people, who they are and, their connection, their entire Jewish connection many times today is not built on Torah, but it's built on their connection to Israel. That's the biggest anchor of Jewish identity for Jews outside of Eretz Israel. And, it's of the toughest balancing act, Rabari. You're absolutely right. It's a clear problem. It's a hard problem. And I think our task with other Jews inside and outside of Eretz Israel is to understand the problem, the way the problem presents for them, and with at this point, a couple of centuries of serious intermarriage issues, making things complicated for many of the Jews who we are speaking with, who are very committed to Israel and the Jewish people. And at the same time, with our millennia old commitment to the absolute truth of the Torah and its definition, and like we can't put that aside for social or political expediencies. So it's not a problem for which anybody has a simple solution. But we can sit down with problems like this in ways that are just not bothering trying to understand the other side. And otherwise, you quoted the Gemara, Eilu Veilu Divrei Elokim Chai. That Gemara also said that the reason why Beis Hillel prevailed was because they listened, because they were Nashim, Valuvin, Dimin Divrei Bishami, Ledivreim, which means that they did best in arguments because they were able to be humble and to listen to what the other side said and then argue with it. But when you argue with someone having truly understood where they're coming from, the position you're going to argue is going to be more nuanced, more practical, and able to be more effective.
Very good. Rabbi Hauer, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Rabbi David Gottlieb. Rabbi Gottlieb learned in Kollel for 10 years before becoming the Rav of Shomrei Emunah, the largest shul in Baltimore. He made Aliyah in 2009 and became a Rav in Beit Shemesh, Ramat Beit Shemesh, and he's also a Magid Shir, and he has published 4 Sfarim, going on 5, and he has given numerous thousands of Shirim, and also for the past 3 years, he has served as the director of Tzalash, which focuses on maintaining and improving the Ruchnias of soldiers in the IDF. Rabbi Gottlieb, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ari. It's a pleasure to be with you once again.
It's great to have you. Now, last time we spoke, Rabbi Gottlieb, we were at the height of Achdus and Klal Yisrael, and unfortunately, that has become fractured more recently. So I'd like to start off with asking you, why is Achdus important for Klal Yisrael?
So I think that the first thing we have to acknowledge is that, sadly, you are correct. A lot has changed since the last time we spoke. And I think to some extent in both directions, the on the left, if you will, or the secular part of the Jewish world has become deeply fractured and, in my opinion, much less focused on unity. Anti-government, anti-Bibi forces have gotten much stronger and more vocal. The protests trying to bring down the government, a very lamentable reality that the hostage families, and we all have obviously incredible rachmonis for them. We can't even imagine what they're going through. But the decision of some of them to join these obviously political rallies to bring down the government, I think it was a mistake. Also, it's really fracturing that level of Achdus. And of course, within the Frum community, particularly the army issue has really been ripping at Achdus. And that's something we had spoken about. And I assume we'll speak about a little bit more. So, yes, things have taken a turn for the worse, and that is very, very sad. You ask, you know, why is Achdus important? So part of my answer is, how much time do you have? But to try to keep it brief, because there's so much both history and Makoros that, you know, make this point. So I'll just try to run through a few of the highlights. For example, we know that Achdus was a prerequisite to Matan Torah. Ki ish echad b'lev echad. We wouldn't have gotten the Torah if we didn't have that. Many point out that the fact that there was similar Achdus in the time of Purim, Lech Knosis Ayudim, is why we had the re-acceptance of the Torah, Mitoch Ava, in the time of Purim. Of course, not only is Shavuos and Matan Torah a theme in that sense, but with Pesach coming up, Rav Huttner, in one of his pieces in Pachad Yitzchak, points out that when the Egyptians are running after Am Yisrael, Chazal, Rashi quotes, use a similar lashon, not ki'ishachad v'levachad, but v'levachad ki'ishachad, which more or less seems like the same thing. And Rav Huttner asks, you know what, we thought we were so special, we had this at Har Sinai, seems like the Egyptians had it also. And Rav Huttner says, the key is the order, that's everything, because the Jewish people are objectively, inherently, one, ki'ishachad. Memela, we're also b'lev echad. We also have similar views and similar commitments. But it starts with ki'ish echad. We are one. Whereas the Egyptians are, or and any non-Jewish nation, are not inherently one or inherently unified. It happens to be that they had mutual interests, and therefore they were b'lev echad. They wanted to get their slaves back. They wanted to get their money back. So because they had mutual interests, so then for that moment, they were ki'ish echad. They were also together. But fundamentally, it wasn't pragmatic for the Jewish people in the way, it was pragmatic, not like the Jewish people who at Har Sinai. It was essential. I think that's, frankly, if I could, that is part of the issue. I think a few months ago, we realized that we were truly brothers, and there was an essential sense of Achdus, and we've lost that, and now it's a pragmatic thing. So to the extent that it's pragmatically good, people are still being unified, but now that many people are feeling it's not pragmatic, they're losing that. And one last point I will just point out, it's not just that Achdus was prerequisite for Kabbalah Satorah, prerequisite for Geula, but it's also a unbelievable prerequisite in times of war. It is the secret weapon of the Jewish people in the time of war. As Chazal say in a number of places, that Doro Shel David, even though they had unbelievable levels of Talmud Torah and Shmir Samitzvos, but because they had Dol Turin, because they would tell Lashon Hara about each other, they were divisive, Hayu Noflin, as opposed to the Doro Shel Achav, which was one of the worst of the worst, Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu. And yet, Yotzen LeMelchama, they were Matzliach in battle. Why? Because they didn't tell Lashon Hara, because they weren't divisive. So at all, if at any time, how could there be more than this time during the war? The fact that we've lost this is really something lamentable, and it's really something we should be thinking about how we can get back to it.
Obviously, yeah, for sure, we have to think about that. Let me get your perspective, because you have an interesting perspective of having been a Rav out of Israel in Baltimore, which is in the United States of America, and subsequently in Israel. So I'd love to compare, contrast the various issues that you've seen, at least at the shul level, on the individual level between people. What are the issues you have to deal with to start with in the United States as it dealt with Achdus, as it has to do with Achdus, for example, maybe in the shul or between shuls, and then we'll move back over to Israel and talk about how maybe things are the same or different.
So maybe I'm happy for any follow-up questions, but I think it might be easier if I just kind of combine the two and create and just point out the contrasts. I think broadly speaking, the differences are both on the issues that divide people and the level of intensity with which that disagreement or divisiveness plays out. As you mentioned, I was the rabbi in Baltimore in Shomrei Emunah, which is an incredibly diverse shul. And I have the schus in Ramat Beit Shemesh. Our shul is much smaller, but it's similarly very, very diverse by Israeli standards. And that's not the same as America. In America, you can have a much even broader diversity. But certainly by Israeli and certainly Ramat Beit Shemesh standards, I think we have a very diverse shul. I happen to love both of those shuls. I love, and I love the diversity, but it certainly is a challenge. I would say in terms of, you know, what's an issue in America and why that's different than in Israel. So again, broadly speaking, I would say attitudinally or emotionally, there's the basic difference that in America, things are simply less intense. They're less intense because the people in general are less intense. They're less intense because people are more spread out. They're not, so to speak, on top of each other. In Israel, and I don't think Ramat Beit Shemesh is alone, right? Part of the reason that, again, we've been in Israel now 14, 15 years, but when we first came, there were some notoriously bad, bad issues that did come up in Ramat Beit Shemesh. Thank God that it's been a while since we've had anything like that. But part of the reason I point out is not so much that people are uniquely, forgive me, bad in Ramat Beit Shemesh, as much as we have the same problems as everywhere else, the same percentage of problems, I would think. But everyone's on top of each other. A lot of parts of Israel and certainly in America, it's big enough that people are in completely different neighborhoods. But in Rabbi Shemesh happens to be that there's a lot of people on top of each other, or two different neighborhoods are right next to each other. So it becomes hard to avoid. And that creates a certain level of intensity, which Israelis are both famous and notorious for. But part of that is not only the attitudinal and the level of intensity, but also the scope and the specific issues. So, for example, in America and in Israel, you can have divisions within the Orthodox community, respectively, that relate to the whole issue of Limudei Chol, or secular education. But in America, again, I'm sure somebody in America who feels very strongly about their position might disagree with what I'm about to say. But from my vantage point, now having been in Israel all these years, you look at the disagreements that can take place about Limudei Chol and in America. I mean, they're minuscule. You know, everyone gets a secular education through high school. Some better, some worse. Huge percentages, including across the more yeshiva or a gudda community, will get some kind of a degree, often secondary and, you know, professional high-level degrees. So do you go to this kind of college or do this kind of online thing? And do you get a B at this? And I'm not saying there are differences, but we're talking the same language. You come to Eretz Yisrael, and not only do you have people on one side, you know, getting regular full secular education, but on the other side, in the Israeli Haredi community, right? There's no secular studies. There's no high school.
A lot more extreme.
It's not just an issue of college or graduate school. We're talking about much earlier and in a much more extreme way. You can't compare. And then, of course, you have the whole issue even of Zionism. So in America, also people discuss these things and they debate them. But in America, what does that mean? Do you say the tefillah for the Medina on Shabbos? Do you say Hallel with a bracha, without a bracha? I mean, these are, again, I'm not making light of them per se, but if you have any sense of proportion or context, these are minuscule issues. Whereas in Israel, it's permeates everything. To what extent are you part of society or not? To what extent do you feel obligated to help, to contribute part of society? Or to what extent do you feel, you know, totally removed? And of course, a nafkamina of that whole issue is the army. But it's even bigger than the army. It's everything. It's not just, you know, a tefillah that you do or you don't say. So there's so much, so many issues. They're so weighty. And everything in Eretz Yisrael by nature is so much more intense that, you know, unfortunately, things can explode very easily here.
Right. You mentioned earlier talking about the left and the divisiveness at this point. I'd like to focus now on the Orthodox, the intra-Orthodox issues. And truth be told, despite the fact that we do have these extremes and significant differences, if we take a step back and think about it, we are probably 90%, 95%, 99%, maybe even 99.5% in agreement. So how should we think about the differences? Are there ways that we can have better understanding with each other in light of, it seems that when we have so many similarities and specific differences, we accentuate the differences and forget about the similarities. So how should we think about these things?
So I agree 100% with the way you framed the issue. There's a famous story. I may not get every detail exactly right, but there's a famous story of somebody who said something provocative, not like what you were saying, many years ago, to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Gush, a very famous Hesder Yeshiva, to which apparently he responded more or less, this is the part that I'm fuzzy on, but more or less he responded, you know, he's very upset with the way they were distinguishing this yeshiva, the Gush, from other Haredi yeshivas. And he made some very strong comments, something to the extent of, you know, we are 90%, or I don't know what number he used, but basically the same point as you did, you know, we're 99% or almost a 95% like Ponovich. That's what we are. We're a little different, but basically we're the same yeshiva. We believe in the same things. We do the same things. So yes, of course, there are differences between Gush and Ponovich, and there are differences across the Orthodox community, but they really should be understood in context, right? All the important things, not just in Kamus, as we would say, cumulatively, but even quantitatively, the important things, Emuna, you know, Torah Mir Shamayim, the Yud Gimli Karim, this is the stuff that the whole Orthodox community agrees on. So peripherally, there's a few things that are important, but I agree with you. They're both minimal and not nearly as important as what we agree on. So you asked me a question of, you know, especially given my experience in diverse environments, what are things that I think we could try to incorporate, all of us individually and communally, so that we would continue to disagree, because we will. These are machloksim l'shem shamayim. And as the Mishnah tells us, if it's a machloksim l'shem shamayim, it is sofo l'hiskayim. So it's not about convincing someone else that you're right or somehow ending the disagreement. That's not going to happen. But the real question is, how can we learn to disagree without being divisive?
I guess you'll have to continue on that thought. I once saw an explanation. If it's a machlokes l'shem shemaim sofo liskayim, it means a machlokes l'shem shemaim. It's going to go on forever because each side thinks they're fighting l'shem shemaim.
Right,
so what
right.
we have to talk about is not that perush, the alternative perush.
Right. Correct. I understand that. Anyway, so I think, you know, in Israel, they say, you know, I think there's a saying something like, you know, we can have chilukei deot without chilukei levavot or pirud levavot. In other words, you can disagree because there'll be chilukei deos, but there doesn't have to be the pirud, you know, and the divisiveness and the personal stuff. So I would humbly suggest perhaps a few things which have helped me in my own life, professionally and personally. You know, I think if people who know me well know that, you know, I'm a Baal Shita. You know, I have, you know, views that I feel strongly about. And yet I think that professionally and personally, I've been able to get along with very different types of people. And I've learned from other people, parents, Rebbeim, also who know how to get along with other types of people. And I feel like, you know, there are a few, if you will, strategies or just insights or perspectives that if we all had, I think they really would help us. So first of all, I would suggest it's incredibly important. Again, it sounds so obvious, almost to be a cliche, but unfortunately, we don't see it practiced enough. And that is a certain sense of humility and respect for opposing views. The issues that we're alluding to, whether it's the army, which we'll get back to, or other types of issues, these are unbelievably, unbelievably complex. And as far as I'm aware, you know, no one has any nevuah. No one was told definitively from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that their approach is correct. So everyone's trying to do their best. Everyone sincerely thinks that they're correct, but have a little humility to know that, you know, maybe someone else has a truth that you don't 100% have. That would change everything. Have a little respect for the opposing view, especially if we're talking about something which is clearly under the rubric of Eilu v'Eilu Devar Kelim Chayim. I mean, just take one obvious example, the whole issue which we mentioned about secular studies. I mean, that's not a new topic. Yes, college versus not college, that's a modern iteration, but it's not a new topic. It was a machlokas in the Tanaim. It was a machlokas in Gedolim and Rishonim and early Achronim. For centuries, there have been different Gedolim who took different approaches to whether they called it Limurei Chol or, you know, Chachma Yevanis or Limurei Chutz or other such things. It's clearly an Eilu v'Eilu Devar Kelim Chayim. There have been Gedolim throughout the generations on both sides of that. So whatever your personal view is, whatever yeshiva you're part of, whatever chatzer, whatever, you know, that's fine. But to have no respect for the other view, given its, you know, the humility you should have, number one, and number two is the fact that this is a clearly a mainstream view within Hashkafa, you know, of Klal Yisrael. I mean, that would already would not, again, I'm not talking about changing a view one iota. Believe what you believe, but have a little humility and respect for the other view. That's number one. And number two, which I guess is, you could say, is related, but I do think is a different point, is being down the kaf schus, in the sense that so often in the most heated rhetoric, you hear, unfortunately, people assuming the worst about the people that they're disagreeing with. Either the worst about them in the most general sense, or the worst about their particular motivations. Oh yeah, you're only disagreeing with me, or you're only advocating a certain position because, and then you fill in the blank. And so to speak, it's coincidence that all those things you're filling in the blank with, which you assume are the motivations of this person you disagree with, none of them are flattering, to put it mildly. Somehow we always assume the worst about the motivations or the character of the people we disagree with. Dan lekaf schus, give people the benefit of the doubt. They may be wrong, but assume that they're coming with the best of intentions. And as I think it's the Sfas Emes or others in their commentary to Pirkei Avos note, it's not just done, you know, as ha'adam lekaf schus, but it's done as kol ha'adam lekaf schus. Look at the big picture of the person. Even when you disagree with the person, even when you're sure that a person is wrong about the specific thing, but you don't have to, so to speak, you know, postle and condemn the whole person. The person is comprised of a lot of things, and there may be many other aspects of their personality that you like and that you agree with. Some are people who I love, who I really enjoy and love, who I really disagree with. So they might be wrong about that one thing, in my view. Remember, humility. But Don es kol ha'adam.
So Don es kol ha'adam, meaning there's a hey there. It's not just the Adam, it's ha'adam. Look at the entirety of the individual.
Yeah. Correct, yes. And as the first approach, the simpler, the more pashut prat is, when you see someone that looks like they're doing something wrong, so in that one moment, don't judge them for l'chov, but think about ways in which you can justify, so to speak, what they're doing. But Danas Kol Ha'adam is, no, maybe what they're doing is wrong, but keep it in context with the larger truth of who this person is, which is a good person. So that's, I think, a second point. It's not only the humility and respect for opposing views, but the Dan Lekaf Schus or Kol Ha'adam Lekaf Schus, I think that's a second point. Again, I'm not talking about giving in one iota to the views you feel strongly about, but the way you view other people, assuming the best of them, the best of their intentions. And last but not least, maybe the most important thing I would say is, if we start from the perspective that the people that we're disagreeing with are our family, they're our brothers and our sisters, it will change everything. Because in the end, family is family. But we forget about that. We other the people that we disagree with. We demonize the other people that we disagree with. And then there's no limit to the types of things, unfortunately, that we will do when we think we are fighting the holy war on behalf of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as you alluded to. That will be a sofo she'enu l'skayim, as you point out. Those machloksim never end and never end well, that's for sure. But if we remember that we're really family, so everything will be different. I think it was a few years ago, I heard from Rav Chaim Tzvi Center, who's a close Talmud of Rav David Cohen, Rosh Hashiva of Hebron. So he has one sister. And I believe, as far as I understand, this is all secondhand, but I believe that she's religious, but I think she's Dati Lumi, or Mizrahi, as he put it. And Rabbi Center, who's very close with Rav David Cohen, said he has seen them together at Simchas. And you see the way they interact with each other. Brother-in-law, sister and brother, they love each other. Doesn't mean that they agree. Maybe they really disagree on a lot of things, but they haven't forgotten that they're family. Or many people might know the Bayan Rebbe, the current Bayan Rebbe in Yerushalayim, has a sister who lives in Teaneck. Very, very different the way they're raising their families and their respective hashkafos. But they go to the Simchas in Eretz Yisrael. The Rebbe comes to the Simchas in Teaneck. This is well known, very public. And it's obvious the love and respect that they have for each other. In my own family, not on the religious level, but even on the political level. My father has two siblings. They're very different than him politically. And he told me so many times as I was, growing up, that the key is to remember that that's the most important thing.
It's family.
Yes. And because of that, he told me once, he said, once you realize that it's family, then you realize that the relationship is always more important than the issue. On a practical level, my father gave me the advice because of that. So on certain things which he knows he's not going to agree with his brother or sister on, they just don't want to talk about it. What's the benefit of talking, let alone arguing about something you know you're not going to agree with? The only thing that could possibly happen, not necessarily, but possibly, is that you insult the other person or you hurt the other person's feelings or they hurt your feelings. But there's no upside. There's only downside. So if you prioritize the relationship over the issue, you'll just avoid it. And if I can mention, I heard this many, many times and for many years from my father, but I heard something very similar from one of my own Rebbeim, Rav Mordechai Willig, Rosh Shiva YU, my Rebbe, and a longtime rabbi in Riverdale, has had a very long, decades now long, close relationship with Rav Avraham Elazban, the Telzer Rosh Yeshiva in Riverdale. And it's well known how close they are. They get along with each other. And it's all true. But Rabbi Willig once told me that part of the reason they get along so well, not just because they actually respect each other, it's not just because they actually like each other. Those things are both true. But it's also true, said Rabbi Willig, that we pretty much never discuss the things that we disagree about. Obviously, he has certain views that Rabbi Elazban doesn't agree with. And Rabbi Elazban has certain views that Rabbi Willig doesn't agree with. And as Rabbi Willig told me, I'm not going to convince him, and he's not going to convince me. So what would be the point of discussing those? So we never do. We discuss Torah, we discuss our families, and we discuss the myriads of issues that we do agree with. That's a perfect recipe. Don't look for machlokas. Prioritize the relationship over the issue.
Very good. So if we apply those three strategies, klalim, humility, number one, number two, dan nekaf schus, and number three, remembering we are dealing with family, if we could get to the hot potato, the issue that is discussed in Israel, it's discussed on headlines. If you could shed a little bit light, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but maybe just a little bit light on the divisive issue of the arm. We have on the one hand, we have the non-observant demanding that everyone serve equally, equality. And the other hand, we have the Haredi public that is learning and focused on the Shmir of Klal Yisrael from the base Medrash. And in the middle, kind of, we have in the crossfire, we have the Dati Lumi, the Hezder Yeshivas that are bridging the gap, and they are serving in the army, albeit less than full service sometimes with the Hezder program, but they are serving, but they're also learning. So what's going on here? How do we apply the steps of humility, dan lechav schut, we are dealing with family, when we have very tangible issues, and they're very not only ideological issues, but very practical issues. If somebody's not serving in the army, then the terms of those who are serving have to be extended. So this is not just ideological, but there is a really practical impact of the issues from one to the other.
So I'm happy to answer that even very directly. But let me just be mocked him, if I could, just for a moment, even before that, just to kind of set the stage. And I want to point out, not only just because I want to be diplomatic, but because I actually believe it's true, that I really do believe that there's a tremendous amount of fault in both directions. And I don't know the answer, nor do I think it would be important to try to figure out who's more at fault, who started. It doesn't interest me in the least. But I do think it is fair to, you know, acknowledge that there really have been some mistakes, you know, in both directions. You know, as we mentioned at the outset of our conversation, you know, just 6 months ago, you know, it was a completely different reality. And there was tremendous love and mutual respect, genuine respect of the contributions that each side was making. And, you know, we certainly have lost that. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. But one of the reasons that we have lost that is simply because of a lot of the language that we hear from leaders of all sides. And yes, it's true that not all, but some of the politicians who are calling for Haredi, you know, mandatory enlistment in the army, you know, speak very, very negatively about the Haredi community. It goes without saying that they don't have respect for the Torah learning or the mitzvos. But more than that, you know, the kind of statements that refer to people as leeches or, you know, or cynical about their motivations, you know, and are threatening all sorts of things, you know, in it, there's no other area of our life where we would think that that would be a successful way of solving any problem. So why would we think that this one would be? But it's also, I think, fair to point out that, you know, the lashon and the language in coming from the Haredi world has not exactly been perfect either. Again, I'm not here to discuss who started it or who went first, but the reality is there's a lot of very negative language, assuming the worst about people who want them to serve or who are serving, demonizing people who serve or people, you know, who disagree with them. You know, again, I don't want to get into the specifics and I don't want to name rabbis. That's not my style, but I have receipts and I'm not the only one. This is well known, unfortunately, and it's been very, very painful. Last but not least, I think it's just an important point, and this, I guess, segue to answering the question the way you asked it, which is, you know, how can we apply the things I talked about? So when we talk about humility or respecting the other side and knowing where they're coming from, which is kind of an empathy. So the first point I'll mention, which I think, you know, perhaps for our listening audience is an important one, is that part of what has changed over the last few months, which is no one's fault, unlike what I already mentioned, which I am blaming people for, but this is no one's fault, which is as the war went on and got more intense and Nebuch, more soldiers died, Al Kiddush Hashem, what became, you know, everyone knew this in theory, but what became, you know, unavoidable in a very painful, visceral way was the fact that all of the deaths are coming from one part of the community and none from the other part. So you have obviously a certain number of non-religious soldiers who have died Al Kiddush Hashem, a very high percentage, disproportionate number of religious Zionist Dati Lumi soldiers who have died Al Kiddush Hashem. You don't have, you know, people from B'nai Brak and Kiryat Sefer. You don't have Haredi people dying Al Kiddush Hashem in the army because they're not in the army. And that's just a fact. And the more that we as a community in Israel have been dealing with these horrific, painful deaths and funerals, et cetera, it just became very, very hard for people to look away from that. There's a very significant Talmud Chacham named Rav Chaim Navon, Chaber of numerous Sfarim, who lives here in Israel, one of a very, very significant, as I say, Talmud Chacham in the Dati Lumi community. And he wrote a very, very powerful piece, L'Shem Shemayim, trying to speak to the Haredi community as his brothers. But the headline more or less was, you know, when was there an agreement that we would die and you would clean up our blood, which is an incredibly powerful way of asking the question or framing, you know, people have been saying, well, you know, you guys go to the army and we're in Zaka. You know, we have, you know, and it's true. There are many wonderful Haredi Chesed organizations, but, you know, there was no national referendum on, as Rav Chaim Navon put it, we'll go to the army, we'll die, and you'll do nice Chesed, you know, during, before, and after. Now, again, I'm not trying to resolve that. I'm not trying to convince anyone who's right. That's not the point of this conversation. But when you have people, even from people, Talmid Chachamim, who are feeling that level of pain, so if you are Haredi, if you do have the view that you don't think the yeshiva boys or the Haredi boys should be going to the army, you need to be able to, A, have empathy, understand where another community is coming from, what they've been sacrificing, what they've been, the pain that they've been feeling. You know, I live in a community, other people live in communities in which you have, you know, many, many, many wives and mothers, you know, who haven't been able to sleep well for months, worrying about, you know, what's happening with their son or with their husbands. Right? That is just not a reality in the Haredi world. So again, maybe there's a good reason for it. I'm not trying to say not, but you can't approach this issue if you have no sense or you don't display that level of empathy and that understand that humility and that appreciation for the other side. And I'm not saying nobody does, but in too many examples, unfortunately, the Dati Lumi community hasn't felt the positive warmth and love and empathy. And often, or at least too often, it's been even worse than that. So yes, disagree. Gesunte Heit, if you really feel strongly that the Haredim should go to the army, so then make that view, but do it with respect. Don't be cynical and say, oh yeah, all those yeshiva guys, nobody learns. They don't even believe in it. They're all leeches. That's a horrible, horrible thing to say. Treat the other side with respect. You think they should go to the army? Okay. But recognize that the Haredi community has tremendous values and they truly believe in the lifestyle that they lead and they're contributing in many ways to society. You disagree? Okay, so try to make a good faith argument why you think that they should reconsider. But do it from a perspective of not only humility in your own position, but great respect for them. And of course, the opposite, as I've already alluded to as well. If you feel that the Haredi community shouldn't go to the army, so then make that argument as well. But you don't have to do it by denigrating the Chilonim and saying that all of them are Rishayim, or the only reason they want the Haredim to go to the army is because they're trying to make us not from. And you don't have to do it by bashing the Dati Lumi community. Right? Many of the articles and other such things are, you know, recently advocating the Haredi approach have gone out of their way to talk about how so many Dati Lumi are not from in the army and da-da-da. They're ad hominem, they're personal attacks, and they're also not based on actual real knowledge. There's a lot, again, I want to get into the details, but a lot of it is not even accurate. So make the argument why you don't think the Haredim should go to the army, or make the argument why you think they should go to the army, but with humility, with Dan Lakav's chust, realize that everyone really believes in their respective position, that they want the best for the Jewish people, they want the best for their children. They really believe in things. They have values. They're not the same values that you have. They don't believe the same thing you have in this issue. Okay, but with respect, with humility, with appreciation, with cheshbon and nefesh, etc. If we could do that, we could still disagree about this unbelievably volatile issue. But I think it goes without saying that that type of disagreement will be completely, completely different than the type that unfortunately we've seen over the last few months, and honestly, that we've been seeing for decades over this particular issue.
In a nutshell, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. You can say we're not going to serve, et cetera, but say it with empathy, say it with understanding, humility. These are back to your three klalim. Number one is humility. Number two is dana kaschus. Maybe the other team, the other group of our family has proper intentions. And remember, we are dealing with family, and also to add on, we're dealing with people who are being moser nefesh, literally moser nefesh.
Yeah, again, a great appreciation and understanding. Again, I mentioned the Elu Be'elu. Over the decades since the founding of the family state of Israel, there have been great gedolim who have disagreed about this issue. Not all the Gedolim are on one side of this. There have been great Gedolim who disagreed. So you are allowed to follow your view. I'm not saying not. I'm not advocating one way or the other at the moment. I'm just saying understand that other people have a legitimate view. They come to it sincerely. They have great Gedolim behind them. They are doing their best because they believe in it. They're being moser nefesh. You disagree? Disagree in that context, not in the demonizing ad hominem personal assuming the worst about people context.
Right. Now, Rabbi Gottlieb, final thoughts for our listeners, if you could tell us, talk to us about Achdus, any departing words that you have.
Well, if it would be okay, I'd like to share with you, if I could, a story. And if you'll let me know if I run out of time, but an Advar Torah. And since I am a shul rabbi, if I have to pick, I'll go with the story first. And that way, if no one ever complained about not getting the last of our Torah, but they don't get the last story, you know, that would be rabbinic malpractice. So I hope I can get in both. But if not, you'll wave me off when I get to the Advar Torah. But I just want to mention, if I could, it's one of my favorite stories. I have mentioned it over the years in various different shiurim, and I think it really goes to the heart of what we are talking about, not only because it indirectly relates to the army, but it really focuses on a more basic point, and that is as follows. There is a concept called the secular machina, the idea of taking kids after they graduate high school, non-religious kids, before they go to the army, to spend a year helping them understand Zionism and secular values and, you know, the history of the state of Israel and why they're doing this, et cetera. I'm not even sure, honestly, how many kids do this, but it's such a phenomenon in Israel. And one of the heads of this, someone named Uriel Eldad, as part of his education of these kids during that year, he takes them to Har Herzl, which, of course, is the famous National Military Cemetery in Yerushalayim. And if anyone has been there, and you should be there, as some of you may know, Rav Shmuel Zalman Orbach used to say to the yeshiva boys, if you want to daven by Kibrei Tzadikim, go to Har Herzl, where the soldiers are buried, because they are Tzadikim, they died on Kiddush Hashem. So it's a very powerful place. And among other things that you will find there is they bury the soldiers who've been killed in sections based on what war they were killed in. So there's a whole section in Har Herzl that is from the 1948 Melchemet Ha'atzmut, the Independence War. And there you will see some graves, which amazingly, and he was showing this, Uriel Eldad was showing the students he had, graves that have no name. But rather it says just, this is Kever Almoni. Americans might be familiar with the phenomenon of the tomb of the unknown soldier. Someone is buried here, we don't know his name. It says Almoni, Nafal Bekrav, Yerushalayim, he died in battle for Yerushalayim, you know, the date, whatever it was, Yud Iyar, Tavshin, Chet, or something like that. Kever Almoni. So these young 18, 19-year-olds couldn't understand it. How could it be that there's somebody in the state of Israel who died, but we don't know his name? So Uriel explained to them that these are soldiers. This is 1948, 1949, who, right after the Holocaust, right after the Shoah. And so many came on the boat. They got to what was then known as Palestine, Eretz Yisrael, and they were handed a gun, go fight. You have to understand, he explained, these are people who came from Europe. Their entire families had been decimated, had been killed. They were the only surviving members of their family after the Holocaust, after the war. They had lost everyone. They crawled to Eretz Yisrael somewhere. They got there. Here's a gun, go fight. And now he's killed. There's nobody else alive who even knows his name. Maybe some of the people he was fighting with knew his name, and they were killed with him. Nebuch, these are people who, Holocaust survivors, their family was killed in Europe, and now they're killed here. We just don't know their name. So he tells them this, and this is basically the facts. This is true. But the kids are agitated, and they can't process this. What does that mean? He has no name, and does that mean no one visits him, and he doesn't, you know, what's going on? Sometime later, a week later, more, I'm not sure, but a different day, Uriel gets a phone call. Uriel, matzanu et ha-mishpacha shelo. Matzanu et ha-mishpacha shelo. They were so excited to tell him, we figured it out. We found out who his family is. So Uriel's like, well, what are you talking about? He goes, you don't know, Kever Almoni. Kever Almoni? You found the family? There is no family. It's been decades. That's why it's called Kever Almoni. No. He said, matzanu et ha-mishpacha. You found the family? What do you mean? How did you find the family? To which they responded, anachnu ha-mishpacha. Anachnu ha-mishpacha shelo. We realized we are his family. And every year, this group comes back to the cemetery on his yahrzeit. That's the power of recognizing family. If we would just go through all these issues, disagree, have your opinions, but remember in the context, anachnu ha-mishpacha, we're family, it would change everything. Everything. It would make us agree, but it would make us be agreeable. We would be divided, but we would not be divisive. There'd be chilukei deos, but there wouldn't be chilukei levavos. Do I have time for another Dvar Torah, or am I done?
Absolutely. It would be podcast malpractice if I said you can't give a Dvar Torah.
Okay. I won't deny that I might have been a little bit manipulated by doing that. Anyway, very briefly, it's a very powerful Dvar Torah, and I think it echoes the same point. On Monday and Thursdays, when we lane the Torah, we have Kriyas HaTorah in Shul. So afterwards, as we're putting away the Torah, the Chazan says the Yihi Ratzon. And there's a number of paragraphs, and we ask Hashem, Yihi Ratzon, L'hashiv es Shechinaseinu Shechinaso b'mehera, please Hashem, return your Shechina, Yihi Ratzon, L'rachem Aleinu v'al Pleit Aseinu, Hashem, have mercy on us, on our families, on our descendants, Yihi Ratzon, L'kayim Banu Chachma Yisrael, please Hashem, support and help the great leaders, the great Talmid Chachamim, Yihi Ratzon, there should be B'suras Tovus, Yishos Nachomos, V'kabes Nidachenu. We keep on saying Yihi Ratzon, please Hashem, let it be your will for all these good things. The Chazan says all this, and then what happens after the Chazan finishes all the Yiratzons? Then the Shul, then the Tzibur responds with Achenu. And in Achenu, we also ask for lots of things. We say, Hashem, Yirachem Aleinu, have mercy on us. Take us, Mir Tzara L'Ravacha, Me'afela L'Ora, Mishibud L'Geula. All these wonderful, powerful things that we're asking for, Hashem, Hashem, please. So I heard once many years ago that Rav Shach, the Chatzadik of Karshal Baruch Hu, asked, I don't understand the inconsistency. A minute earlier, when the Chazan's asking for all of his good things, he says, Yihi Ratzon. He says, Hashem, please, may it be your will, XYZ. But when the next minute later, when the Tzibur responds with Achenu, we ask for all these things, but there's no Yihi Ratzon. What happened to the Yihi Ratzon? What happened to the please, Hashem? So Rav Shach answered, there's a single difference, but it's a fundamental difference which makes all the difference. You know why there's no Yihi Ratzon? Because once you have Achenu, you don't need the Yihi Ratzon. Achenu, in essence, is the Yihi Ratzon. Once we remind the Kadosh Baruch Hu, we're brothers, we're with each other. So what father doesn't want to help his children, especially when he sees his children getting along? That is in essence.
It's an automatic yes.
When you have the Achenu, you don't need the Yihi Ratzon. And boy, Ari, do we need Yihi Ratzons now. Enemies from without, challenges from within. So we are asking Hashem for so many Yeshuas. But maybe instead of asking for all the Yeshuas, we should just look at each other, look to the left, look to the right, and say, Achenu. And if we realize that we are all brothers and sisters, Memela, all those things we want, Hashem hopefully will give us.
Very beautiful. Very beautiful, Rabbi Gottlieb. I want to thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Joining us now is Yoni Alon. And Yoni serves in the reserves of the IDF and recently wrote an article about his experiences serving over the past few months. The article was called Mutti and I Serve in the IDF Together. We couldn't be more different. And I wanted to invite Yoni to speak about his experiences with Mutti, who is somebody who's Dati, somebody who's from, and to hear about their relationship, how they got along or don't get along. Yoni, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm happy that this article caught the attention of many people out there. Yeah.
It certainly caught my attention. So why don't we start out by hearing some background on who you are where you grow up and your maybe your political views, because I think that's relevant also to our conversation.
Definitely. So I'm 36 years old. I live in Tel Aviv. I grew up in a family which was it was a very interesting mix of having a father from a Libyan background, North African background, and I would say somewhat traditional, somewhat, at some times even religious, and a mother that was Ashkenazi from Poland, secular. So it was a fusion of identities and a fusion of ideas. And I remember going to bed with bedtime stories from the Torah, really. You know, that these were my bedtime stories about King David and Solomon and Yosef. So I grew up very Jewish, but I would say not practicing a lot of the laws of our tradition. And I live in Tel Aviv today. I'm actually single. I'm going out on dates, which is very interesting, but it's a different podcast. And I'm a Jewish professional working in the Jewish world, self-employed, mostly working in the field of connecting Israelis to North American Jews and otherwise connecting North American Jews to Israel, specifically for Momentum Unlimited and the Jewish Agency for Israel and other organizations. Yeah, that's
very cool. Nice. Very nice. So walk us through, who is Moti? How long have you known him and what's his background?
So Moti and I, both of us served in an armored brigade. Yeah, in a tanks unit. Up in the north, and we know each other for the last 8 or 9 years. Since I got there, he was there even before that. Moti is, I would define him as, in Hebrew we say chardali. Yeah, Haredi Leumi, so national Haredi. So I would say that he's very orthodox in my perspective, you know, coming from secular Tel Aviv. He takes his practice of Judaism very seriously and study every day, goes to the mikveh every day. He doesn't go out of Israel, so he believes that he is not allowed to travel outside of the land, travel outside of Israel. He usually doesn't eat the meat in the IDF because he believes it's not kosher enough. So he is very, very firm, I would say, and very proud Jew, lives in a settlement in the Shomron, and a computer programmer. So, a great guy, very intelligent, very successful. And, you know, we had a very interesting encounter when we met for the first time 8 years ago. He used to make fun of me, you know, coming from Tel Aviv, the single guy who didn't get married yet, very involved in Judaism and very involved in Jewish world, but coming with a very narrow knowledge of Judaism. Most of my knowledge, I would say, it's cultural. It's less about the philosophy and the Talmud and the Gemara. And, you know, I don't know, we just clicked because I love his devotion to Torah, to Judaism. And I think he loves my devotion to the IDF and maybe also the general notion of being a part of the Jewish people. We just clicked.
So we have significant differences religiously, at least. Do you consider him a friend of yours?
I consider him a friend of mine. You know, I would invite him to my future wedding that I hope to have one day. You know, am I giving him a call outside of the military and telling him, you know, let's have a drink together, let's meet? No, but I'm not doing it with any of the guys. I mean, here in Israel, we have this, it's kind of a social behavior in which these friends are your very good friends, but in those IDF training, in those IDF operations, when you go home, you're going back to your non-military friends. But, I would enjoy an evening with him, you know, and I consider him my friend. It's funny, I was actually thinking about him the other day, and then you sent me an email about this article, which is maybe, Ashgacha, but I was thinking that in my future wedding, I will invite him and I will invite all of my military friends, and he will come to the wedding. He will not eat from most of the food. Why? Because it's not kashrut badatz. So I will need to get him a special order only for him for kashrut badatz, and I will do it now because I want him to be able to have a meal in my wedding.
Beautiful, but maybe he'll be the mesader kiddushin.
maybe.
Okay, very good. So politically, we see religiously there are significant differences. How about politically? Are there differences, and if so, do you discuss politics with him?
Yeah, politically the differences are vast. You know, he would say I'm not sure he will consider himself to be very right wing. But he's there. He's very right wing. I'm on the left. You know, I'm not very left, but I'm definitely central left. You know, I do believe in a general scope of it, in a general notion, I do believe in a two-state solution. Though we have to say, after October 7, it seems crazy. But it is something that is still in my mind. And I think Moti, of course not. Moti believes in Eretz Yisrael HaShlema, and Moti has a very different political perspective. And do we talk about it? So I think that's one of the beautiful things in the IDF. It is this unspoken agreement in which we don't talk about politics. We make an effort, really. We make an effort not to talk about politics, definitely not within the pure military experience. So like within the situation room where everything is happening, because all of us, we are sitting in this very large situation room that is in charge on the coordination, on the military coordination of all of the large portion of the border. You will not speak about politics there. Outside of the room, next to the coffee station, when you have your Turkish coffee, maybe over there you'll have a political joke. But I think all of us understand that it's the opposite of having a glue that brings us together. You know, it's just, I don't know, give me an example for the opposite material of a glue. It's like an acid that breaks apart the bonds between people. That's what that's what became very clear to us in the last military experience we had.
So point number one is you don't discuss politics. How about other areas that you have differences? Would you globalize that and say, if we know we disagree, we're going to avoid it? Or is it only politics that you avoid?
First of all, we had some nice discussions about Judaism. You know, even inside a situation room, we had some nice discussions about the Parashat HaShavua, about some issues in the Gemara that Moti shared with us. And we discussed all kind of issues coming from the Gemara and Dinei Kashrut also. And it was interesting. I think many young soldiers that, well, we have to say not most of us are secular, but I would say, you know, in that unit, which is, you know, it's a room of about 100 people, maybe between 30-40% are Orthodox. 60% are secular. So many of the secular people, they have questions. You know, they have questions about kashrut. They have questions about all kind of issues they're curious about. So they would come to Moti and ask him questions, and he will explain them, you know, from this masechet and this masechet. So Judaism, yeah, we would talk about that. We would maybe talk about general aspects of the Israeli society. But I think we each one of us have this this meter, you know, that this electric meter that... We try to measure the amount of discomfort and tension that a certain topic brings up to the room, you know. And we, it's a, how do you say, it's a barometer, yeah, a barometer.
Barometer, very good.
And we notice, I'm starting a conversation now about something that is going to bring a lot of tension into this military situation, and that is wrong. So I'm going to stop now, and I'm going to take a step back. It happened to me even, you know, outside of this conversation with Moti. It happened to us in the room when we talked about civilians being hurt in the war, Palestinian civilians being hurt in the war. How many civilians is it okay to affect in such a military campaign? And immediately we noticed that it's a very sensitive topic, so we stopped. You know, okay, so we're not going to talk about that now.
Very wise, very wise. Okay, so number one was avoid politics for the most part. Number two is avoid topics that can cause tension. Anything else that's important to maintain a working relationship with somebody when you're under those intense conditions?
I think it's the general notion that I'm not going to cancel who you are based on the things that you do that I don't believe in. So if you've decided that you are not going to travel abroad and travel outside of the land of Israel because that's something you believe in, I'm not going to make fun of you for that. I'm not going to look at you and say, oh, this crazy guy, he decided not to travel abroad because it's forbidden. I respect that. I respect your devotion to your lifestyle and to your beliefs. And then I hope that you can find the ability to respect my lifestyle as someone that is not from and lives his life here in Tel Aviv. I think that mutual respect, you know, that mutual understanding. I'm not going to try to change who you are, but I do want to share about my life and infuse some kind of curiosity in order to make you, maybe ask me questions about my life. But I don't want to turn you, if I'm talking to Moti, I don't want to turn you to a secular guy who lives in Tel Aviv. And I hope you don't want to turn me into a settler who lives in the Shomron and goes to the mikveh every day.
Very good. So let me ask you one final question for you. These concepts we're talking about, because obviously we have such diverse people religiously, politically, so many reasons that we are so different. And nonetheless, we're getting along and we're getting along nicely and we're being sensitive to each other and we're learning what topics to avoid, what we can discuss, what we shouldn't discuss. And even if we discuss something, we see it's causing a little bit of tension. Let's avoid it. Can these concepts be applied out of the context of the military? Do you think that these are concepts that can be applied more to Israeli society, the left, the right, the Chiloni, the Haredi, the Dati, or is this something specific to the IDF?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Is the article I wrote can only be applied to military situation when all of us are wearing, by the way, this is an interesting aspect, all of us are wearing the same clothing, all of us look the same, we have uniform. So it's more easy in the military than outside of it. I don't know. You see, it takes me a while to find the right words. I think if you bring people into the room, outside of the military situation, and you make them understand that it's going to be worth their time to compromise for certain things and to respect each other and to believe in each other for the purpose of the common goal, then things can work. It's a matter of how do you make a very different group of people, very, very different people in one group to believe in one common goal. I think that's a great challenge. And by the way, a compromise and compromises, I think that's the name of the game. Even someone like Moti, who is very devoted and, very, very much devoted to the cause of his spiritual journey, having a seat on the table, having a seat in the Israeli table, will require to make some compromises. I like to say that this country was created by compromises. Yeah, David Ben-Gurion had to sit together with people that he didn't agree with all the time and make some compromises. And that's why we have a country today. So I believe it's possible. I think it's slowly happening in all kinds of places. And more Israelis, I think, are looking on October 7 as some kind of a breaking point in which, or a wake up time, was a wake up call for them, realizing that it's time to make a change. We need to come together in a better way.
Right. Very good. Let's just hope that the keyword respect for people, despite diversity, we should not have adversity.
Yeah. I agree with that.
Very good. Yoni, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I've learned a lot. It's been very interesting. I don't get to have these conversations all day with somebody who is not observant, talking about a friend who goes to mikveh every day. So this is very unique and special for me. So I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Ari. And it's been a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Joining us now is Rabbi Shai Schachter. Rabbi Schachter serves as the rabbi in Rosh Beis Medrash at the Young Israel of Woodmere. He is also the Rav and spiritual leader of Yachad and also the rabbi of Kam Simcha. Rabbi Schachter, thank you so much for joining us.
Rabbi Ari, thank you so much. It's great to be back again.
It is good to have you. I'm doing this topic because I am personally confused. What does Achdus mean? So I'd like to start with the following question. What is your definition of Achdus? And is that the same as Kiruv? It seems to me that they may be different things. It seems that you can have Achdus via Kiruv, but Kiruv is that we're reaching out to people and we want to teach them mitzvahs. On the other hand, Achdus seems to be something else maybe. So I'll leave it to you if you can define Achdus and Kiruv for us and if there's a difference between them.
Very interesting question. I think that you're correct in some way because Kiruv is one manifestation of Achdus. But I think that Achdus itself is far more expansive. I think that we should not judge successful Achdus, and it should not be measured by someone becoming frum or not. I think it has to be a lot more than that. Personally, for me, You know, the Ramchal is such a poetic, beautiful writer. I mean, he doesn't need any of our Haskama. But if you look through the Mesilas Yesharim and some of the other Sifrei Ramchal, it's just beautiful to read through. I have very few things on my desk. I like to be neat. But something that I keep on my desk all the time is a line from the Ramchal. And when I first saw it, it just stuck out at me. And he writes, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ohev Ela Lamisha Ohev Es Yisrael. He says, the Ribono Shel Olam loves those people who love his children. And the Ramchal puts it into layman's terms. And he explains, the same way, if as a parent, I'm in the supermarket or I'm in the playground and somebody comes over to me and shares something nice about my child, of course, I'm going to have an appreciation for that individual. So says the Ramchal, the Ribono Shel Olam is the same. Kaviyachol, that if somebody says something or does something positive to his children, there's nothing that can give a parent greater nachas than that. And I think when we consider Achdus and we think about the children of the Ribono Shel Olam, I think we should think about it in that context. You know, the way that the Mefarshim explain it in Pirkei Avos, that Oy Vesabrios and Makarvan La Torah, there's a discussion, is that the same or is that two different segments of a conversation? Oy Vesabrios is on itself something very meritorious, but then Makarvan La Torah comes as a secondary element. And I think it's very important for us to realize that Achdus really comes from understanding that all of us are the children of the Ribono Shel Olam, and the Ribono Shel Olam will appreciate you more if you appreciate his children. To me, that's just a very instructive comment of the Ramchal. It just guides everything, especially in the Rabbanus. When you think about sometimes you have to deal with people who are, you know, not seeing things the same way you do, and sometimes you're put into difficult situations and you're very exhausted or it's very taxing and it's very tiring and it's very demanding. But when you realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a love for people who are willing to do that and are willing to show love and appreciation and care for his children, it gives a whole different perspective.
So would you say that the definition of Achdus is basically focused on the first part of that Ohev es Habrios, and Kiruv would be focused on the second part, Umekarvan LaTorah?
Yeah, sometimes that's a natural outgrowth of the Achdus that we create, but I don't think Achdus should be limited to only being defined as Kiruv.
Right, very good. So let me ask you about your personal involvement activities over the past number of months since October 7th. You've been in Israel, I know, a number of times back and forth. So what's been your focus? I know that part of the focus, at least, has been having the Jewry in Israel feel that the American Jewry is supportive of what's going on here. But if you can tell us, what have you focused on primarily in this regard?
A couple of things. Number one, I think it's important that we show up. Now, not everybody is able to show up. Not everybody has the flexibility or the job that allows them to do that. And not everybody has the support behind them to be able to do that either. I think all of us have opportunities to show that we are connected, even if we don't show up. Showing up is one thing, but again, not everyone can do. Number two, I would say showing that we care. And there are many different ways to show that we care. I'll just give you an example, a personal example, but there was a released hostage that I was recently talking to, and I've come to know a number of them in Eretz Yisrael, and I think it's an opportunity for all of us to just find something. And I've said this many times to people in our shul. Originally, people were coming October 7th and onward as groups, and they were coming, you know, in big gatherings, and it was very important, and I still think it's important to do so. And to see and to bear witness, all of that is correct. However, I think there has to be something beyond that. I think you meet people on your trips. You're introduced to individuals who are going through this terrible time in different manifestations, in different ways. Pick one individual. Do something manageable. Pick someone who you're going to take personal achrayas for. And I felt very strongly about this. Everybody has the ability to take achrayas for at least one of those people. So maybe it's going to mean you meet a mother who lost a child. You meet a family who lost a father. You meet a woman who lost her husband. You meet somebody who has a family member who's being held hostage. All of them need a listening ear. All of them would appreciate a text before Shabbos or once a week just seeing, how are you doing? All of them were terrified this Motzei Shabbos, not knowing what the outcome of the Iranian barrage was going to be. And you know what? If you would have been that person who texted them in the middle of all that crisis and said, I'm thinking of you and I'm worried about you and I'm concerned for your well-being, you have no idea how far that goes. I'll just share, like, personally, one of the released hostages I was talking to recently was very surprised. He referred to me as a Haredi. I think in our circles, we wouldn't call me that. But, you know, in his mind, all religious people are Haredim, and he doesn't understand any of the differences in our communities, which is beautiful and it's great. But he said to me, you know, I didn't know that someone who is a Haredi, meaning not, I don't mean to call out the Haredim, but anyone who's a religious person, I didn't know they can be nice and respectful. And I said, what does that mean? You live in Israel. You probably see religious people all the time. What do you mean you didn't know that? And he said to me, well, I'll tell you the truth. There was a member of my family who became a Baal Tshuva many years ago. And out of respect to that member of the family, when our mother died, I sat Shiva and I went to their home and I wanted to just go along with whatever they were doing, and I was fine with it. And one day they needed to daven shacharis and there was no Sefer Torah, so we went to shul. It was a Monday morning, there was no Sefer Torah, so they went to shul for Kriyas HaTorah and for davening. And he said he wasn't affiliated, so they couldn't do anything with him in the shul, so they decided to give him hagba. He was the avil, they gave him hagba. Whether it was right or wrong to give an avil hagba in the middle of Shiva, I don't know, but they gave him hagba. And he said a whole fight broke out in shul that he heard as to whether or not a unaffiliated Jew is allowed to do hagba. Is he allowed to touch the Sefer Torah? Is he not allowed to? He's not mekayim what the Sefer Torah says. He said, I stood there, I was holding the Sefer Torah ready, I put it down on the bima, and I said, I will never go back to a shul again. This was over 25 years ago. And he said, you're the first religious person that I'm interacting with since that time, and you brought me to your shul, and you're showing me that religious people are able to have midos and are able to be acting differently than the picture I had in my head. Now, Chalila, of course, his image is not the appropriate image of our communities at all. But how easy it is for us to change that picture that someone has in their minds, just to show them, you're Achea Darchi Noam, we're not here for an agenda. We're not expecting anything out of you. It's not a tit for tat. I don't need you to come here or talk to me because I want something out of you or because I want to be Makar of you. I want you to see the beauty of what our community represents, of what we are. And I think that's something that is a tremendous opportunity that we have now when people's hearts and minds are so open, more so than other times. I think it's something that we all have to take advantage of. Honestly, I never appreciated the comment of the Chazon Ish when he said that there's a possibility of a Tinok Shenishba grows up in Eretz Yisrael. I was always surprised by that. I didn't understand what that reality could mean. What do you mean that you don't understand what Shabbos is? What do you mean you don't understand Kashrus and everything that we stand? How do you not know that? Until I started meeting many of these individuals and realizing they really don't have a background. They really don't have an education. And there's not a tremendous animosity. There's just a total lack of understanding of what our communities are. And I think it's so easy for us to try to bring communities together when we just show what we are and what we do best without doing anything more than that.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. I remember that somebody walked into shul I was in and he went to listen into Shir. He was totally unaffiliated, and somebody came over to him and accosted him for not wearing a yarmulke in the shul. What happens to be the halacha, but let's not tell people who are unaffiliated that they need to put on the yarmulke. And if we want to, we should do it in a very delicate way, offering, would you like to put this on your head, and explain the beauty of it, but certainly it has to be approached in a sensitive manner. Just on your point that there are people in Israel that don't have the education, that is 100% correct. I remember there was a banker that was telling me that he works in Yerushalayim, he's from Efrat, and he says, everyone, whether you are observant or not, you know that you don't extend your hand to, if it's a man, to a woman. Everyone knows that. But in Tel Aviv and Herzliya, it is very common that no one has ever heard of that concept, and they will indeed just from lack of education. So Rabbi Shachter, let me ask you another question. What is one account or one experience that you have witnessed, that you've been involved in, that you feel has really brought good achdus to Klal Yisrael?
Just last week, I had the opportunity to bring Lewis Har to Yeshiva University. My father felt very strongly that we should bring him into the Beis Medrash. He should be able to see what Yeshiva Bacham are all about and what it means to sit in the Beis Medrash and daven Ma'ariv and learn. And we brought him in the Beis Medrash, and then spontaneously the boys began to sing in his honor. And they sang, hundreds and hundreds of boys were there singing and dancing, Tov Lahodos Lashem, Vishalu Banam Ligvula, Hoshia Samecha. It was unbelievable. And I turned to Lewis at some point. Again, the man has never been in a Beis Medrash in his life. This was the first time.
And he was one of the Chatufim, one of the captives who were let out.
He was one of the Argentinian hostages who was miraculously rescued. So I was standing there in the Beis Medrash. My father was holding his hand. I was holding the other hand. And I turned to him in the middle as these boys are dancing and singing for him. I said to him, you know, this is a moment that these Yeshiva Bacham will never forget. And he turned to me and he was crying and he said, I'm 71 years old. Trust me, this is a moment that I will never forget. This is so powerful to me. To me, that was, it breaks barriers. And it's something that we have such an easy opportunity to just show people how much we care, how much achrayas we take. And it's something that's, I feel people's hearts and minds, as I said, are open more to it now than perhaps at other times.
Right. If you can give us another experience, another occurrence that you encountered that you saw that were really having an impact here.
You're talking specifically after October 7th or in general? I feel in general, Harbatzos Torah really breaks barriers. I have found, I'm sure you find as well, the emails that you get, the people are drawn to the beauty of Torah. If you post shiurim online, you never know who's going to hear, which requires a tremendous sense of achrayus. I always have a tremendous hesitation. Although I post a lot of shiurim online, I'm always nervous. Maybe I'm going to hurt someone's feelings. Maybe there's a comment I'm going to make that someone's not going to appreciate. It's hard. It's hard to think like that. But when you have the opportunity to make people be drawn to the beauty of Torah, and when you see from the emails that they send and the communities that they're a part of, from the entire spectrum, people sending emails and putting their politics aside, putting their backgrounds aside, putting their dispositions aside, and being able to just share opportunities of Harbatzas Torah and learning Torah, to me, I feel that's a tremendous vehicle of Achdus that we're not even realizing. And now because of the internet and because of the opportunities that we have, I know there's a lot of danger on the internet, but there's also a lot of tremendous opportunity for Hashpa and for bringing Jews together. The world has become much smaller. It's become much larger, but also much smaller. Our communities have become much closer to each other as a result. I mean, there is a story I remember. My father always told us the story that there was a representative of the Eidei Haredes that came to America many, many years ago when Rav Soloveitchik was still in YU. And at the time, he had presented his case that he needed money. He was collecting for the Aniyim and Me'ah She'arim. And Rav Soloveitchik gave him a $1,000 check, which was, again, even now it's a lot of money, but then particularly it was an exorbitant amount of money. And basically this Rav, I forgot who it was, took the check to Rabbi Julie Berman, who was a prominent lawyer at the time, and he showed him, Rav Soloveitchik gave me a $1,000 check, you know, and he's in chinuch. What are you going to give me? You're a lawyer. You're a successful person. Let's see what you're going to give. And he was sure that this was a forgery, and he went into the other room, and he took the check with him, and he called Rav Soloveitchik at home, and he said, did you meet with someone from the Eidei Haredes? He gave him a $1,000 check, and he said, yes. So he said, don't you understand? These are the same people that hang up Pashkevilim in Yerushalayim calling you an apikoros. Why would you give them $1,000? So Soloveitchik said, it's a good question. And I asked it to him yesterday before I gave him the money. And he answered me, no, I assure you it comes from a different fund. So Soloveitchik said, yeah, so he said, why shouldn't I help the Aniyim and Me'ah She'arim just because I don't agree with them? And it was so powerful to me because my father actually shared the story with me when we had, I'll share another story. He actually shared it with me when we had an interesting interaction that happened a couple of years ago. There was somebody who was, I think, a chairman of the board or on the board of a yeshiva in Brooklyn. I'm not going to say any details, doesn't matter. And basically, he had called my father and asked that my father should put a call into some philanthropist that he should help out the yeshiva. My father said, look, if it will help you, I'm happy to call. I'm happy to help out a yeshiva, not a problem. Then my father said to him, you know, I give a shiur in Brooklyn every week. Why don't I ask the person who drives me to bring me a half hour early? I'll stop into the yeshiva during night seder. This way, when I call the philanthropist, I'll be able to say, I went to the yeshiva. The Talmidim are learning very nicely. I spoke to them a little bit, which I thought was very generous of my father. He had no prior relationship and he was taking up his time, but he decided that that's what he was going to do. So this member of the board was so moved that my father was willing to go out of his way, and he thanked him profusely. He was so happy, and he was very grateful to my father. The next day, my father gets a call from the Rosh Yeshiva, and the Rosh Yeshiva said to my father, you know, I heard there was a member of the board who called you, and it's so generous of your time, and it's so nice, but I was thinking about it, you know, I don't know that your hashkafa is really what I want the Talmidim being exposed to. I'm not sure it's really right for them. You know, I know you offered to come during night seder, but maybe it's better if you don't come. My father, without missing a beat, literally did not miss a beat, my father said, okay, so I'll call him without visiting the yeshiva. Not a problem. I'll call him tonight. That was his response. And I was so upset. I said, you know, a yeshiva like that with a Rosh Yeshiva like that who can talk to you like that doesn't deserve to be supported, certainly not by you or anyone you're friendly with. And I was so upset by it, but my father's a big tzaddik and he was fine with it. And I said to my father, why would you want to support such a place? He said, what's the problem? He needs Talmidim and his Talmidim need him and his yeshiva has to survive. So what's wrong? Why shouldn't I help him? So I was so hurt by it. I left the room. I actually called my mother and I said, make sure tonight daddy doesn't call this person because they don't deserve to be supported. Fine. Then I was feeling guilty. Why did I do that? And I called Rav Asher Weiss to discuss it with him. And I asked him, you know, I told him the whole scenario. He said, Shai, the answer is your mother is right, but your father is righteous. That's what he said. Your mother is right, but your father is righteous. And my father at the time told me the story about Rav Soloveitchik with the check. Comes from a different fund, different groups of Jews sometimes need assistance. We don't always have to agree with them. We don't always have to be on the same page about everything. I wouldn't say that we have to, talk so disrespectfully to one another, but to be able to see past that and to see the bigger picture and to understand that everybody has what to contribute and everybody has something that they can give to the Jewish people, and we should be a part of that.
Those are amazing stories about people feeling achrayus, not only for other Jews, but other Jews that have very different views, very opposing and conflicting views than their own, who were actually negative to them, and still they felt the achrayus. So how do we build that feeling of achrayus for other Jews?
I think part of our challenge is that we don't believe in ourselves. People don't feel empowered enough. People don't believe that they can actually make a difference. They think, you know, the leaders are going to do it. The organizations are going to get together. Who do you think the organizations are? Organizations are made up of people. People are the ones who have the ability to make a difference, not organizations. If you reach out and you believe that you can feel empowered to make a difference in someone else's life, you can actually make a difference. You know, the pasuk says in Hazinu that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a El Emunah Ve'ein Avel Tzadik V'Yashar Hu. And we say it in our tefillah on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. We say, V'chol ma'aminim shehu Hel Emunah. What exactly does it mean? The Ribbono Shel Olam is a God of faith. It should be the other way. It's that we believe in him. So the Medrash there writes, I think it's the Medrash on Parashas Hazinu says, what does it mean? Kel Emunah Ve'Einav. Well, it means Shehemin Ba'olam U'Baro, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu believed in his world, and that's why he created it. He took a tremendous leap of faith in creating us. He gave us Bechira. He gave us the ability to make our own choices, sometimes against the better judgment of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to do. But he did all of that because he has a belief that we can actually make a difference. And I think if the Ribbono Shel Olam believes in us, we say it every morning, Bechemla Rabba Emunasecha, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's belief in us. It's not that we have a tremendous belief in him. He has a tremendous belief in us. Ata Verasa, Ata Yitzarta. If we feel empowered, if we feel that we have the ability to make a difference, we can do it. It is possible. And I think sometimes that's what's lacking. People don't realize that they have the ability to make a big difference.
And that does make a lot of sense. So can you give us some examples, maybe specific examples, of what individuals sitting at home, wherever they may be, what can they do to reach out to others, to reach out to those in Eretz Yisrael? How do they get the phone numbers? How do they go about doing this in order to bring about a little bit achdus in our fractured community and world?
I mean, number one, I think, as I said, don't be afraid, don't be nervous, don't feel inhibited or self-conscious. Just understand that you can actually do something. Number two, don't think that you're wasting your time. I remember a number of months ago or last year, I forgot, I was very involved with a community issue and it was taking a lot of my time and it was something that was just distressing me a little bit. And at some point I had spoken to Rav Asher Weiss about it. It's just taking so much of my time and I was involved with this family and it was just a lot. And Rav Asher Weiss told me the following. He said, I sit in my office every day after Shacharis and people come in. And sometimes I say to myself, is this a waste of my time? And he said, his response to himself, this is the inner conversation he has in his own mind, goes as follows. La'achar me'ev esrim shana. Will the Ribbono Shel Olam appreciate the chidushim that I have on many different sugyas and shas? I don't know. Maybe he thinks that my thought process is incorrect and improper, and maybe my chidushim are not so valuable. Will HaKadosh Baruch Hu agree with the psukim that I gave for many different factions of the Jewish community? I don't know. We dive into HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we should say the right thing. We'll only kashal b'dvar halacha, but we have no way to know. Will HaKadosh Baruch Hu be impressed with my harbatzas Torah and the shiurim that I give? I don't know. Just because people in the neighborhood like it doesn't mean that the Ribbono Shel Olam is so proud of it. Maybe there's a different derech halimud that the Ribbono Shel Olam appreciates. But he said, la'achar me'ev esam shana. Can the Ribbono Shel Olam ever have a claim against me that I gave my heart and my ears to other people who needed for me to listen to them? That is absolute chesed. That is absolute kindness. That is doing for someone what somebody else was not prepared to do. There's no way HaKadosh Baruch Hu can have a tain on me for unadulterated chesed that I've done for something, for someone, without asking for anything in return. So number one, to realize you're not wasting your time and you can actually make a difference. And the Ribbono Shel Olam probably will appreciate that. Whether he'll appreciate my other things that I do, it's hard to know, but will he appreciate the fact that I'm helping to invest in the well-being of his children? There's no doubt about it, just like every parent appreciates those who are willing to invest. I think, once again, to focus on Yechidim, when you look at the problem in Eretz Yisrael now, it's like insurmountable, it's overwhelming. And for any Yachid to think that they're going to make the difference is really not a realistic goal, but to really find something that you connect to. If it means a yasom, if it means a yasoma, if it means a woman who's struggling, if it means, you know, a man who's lost his parnasa, it can be so many different things. Just our shul and the Five Towns community in general has started an initiative months ago already. It was not started by us. We get no credit from it. We just publicized it and a lot of people signed up. I think it was designed by Dr. Ari Bergman, who lives in Lawrence. He started this program called Mishpacha leMishpacha, which he has professionals in Eretz Yisrael who have identified families who were either displaced, who lost their jobs, who lost a family member, whatever it may be that they're going through. And they have tried to connect them with a family here that's of similar genre. Like, I wouldn't say that they're all the same religious affiliation. Some of them are religious, some of them aren't. But the members of our community who have younger children were matched up, let's say, with families there who have younger children, or you know, somebody who's single was matched up there with someone who's fighting in the army, who's whatever, something like that. They have an algorithm of how to do it. And I think you signed up to give a minimal amount of money per month to help them. But more importantly, you signed up to 2 phone calls a week and 1 Zoom every other week. And I know that this has been a transformative experience for the members of our community. I would only imagine that it's transformative for the people on the other side. I have no way of knowing. But I assume if they keep picking up the phone calls and they keep going on the Zoom, I assume it's making a difference to them. Again, a small thing to do. We waste so much time on phone calls with people that don't really need so much attention. We waste plenty of time listening to podcasts and listening to all kinds of things that are not Torah podcasts, and listening to the news and watching the news that's just depressing us. Take just a small sliver of that time and dedicate it toward an initiative like this. And this is one of, I'm sure, many. I'm just not aware of all the different opportunities, but there are so many opportunities. And I would say, if you go to Eretz Yisrael on your own, you can develop the relationship on your own. You bump into someone in Tel HaShomer, ask them if they'd be willing to be in touch, if they want to be in touch, and stay on top of it. Send them a gift before Pesach. It doesn't cost you so much. Make sure they understand that you really care. Make every effort before Shabbos, before Yom Tov, to do what you can. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had one of the other released hostages who came, and I don't think she has ever observed a Shabbos before, and she came here, and she had told me in advance she really wants to come because she thinks it will be easier for her to observe a Shabbos if she's with the community where they observe. I said, you don't have to come to America for that. There's plenty of Jews in Israel. She said, you know, I want to come to America. Anyway, we spent an amazing Shabbos together, really unbelievable. And Friday night at the table, she said, you know, I know that Friday night is a time when it's an auspicious time when people give brachos to their children. Did you prepare a bracha for me? And I was very taken aback. It was the first time she ever had a Shabbos meal. And I really didn't know what to say. And I just gave her a bracha as any parent would give to their child. And since then, she has called me every Erev Shabbos to get a bracha before it's Shabbos in Eretz Yisrael. And she calls me Friday morning to get the same bracha again. Now, again, my brachas are not worth so much, but just the fact that we can have a touch point like that, and this is just a simple interaction that all of us have the ability to do. I'm nothing different than anybody else. This was a person sitting at my table. This was a person I met in Eretz Yisrael who asked me if they can come to America. Of course, we accommodated. I think all of us have the opportunity to do that if we're just courageous enough to step in and take one extra little step in trying to facilitate a little bit more creativity in the achdus that we want to create.
Very well said. Very well said. And it doesn't have to be in Eretz Yisrael. People reaching out to Eretz Yisrael, it could be local. There are needs everywhere. We just have to open up our eyes. Just one story for you about what Rav Asher Weiss said about helping people. I recently, last week, went to Bnei Brak to meet Rav Tzvi Rotberg. Rav Tzvi Rotberg is a Karelitz. His grandfather is Rav Meir Karelitz, the eldest brother of the Chazon Ish. And I asked him a very similar question. I said, Rav Tzvi, what's the definition of Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam? Because if it's Talmud Torah, strictly speaking, we should just be learning all the time. We shouldn't be helping people and doing this and doing that. Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam. And he says, that's something I think about a lot. I sit here, I learn at the table, but boys from the yeshivas, the big Rosh Yeshiva, come up and they ask for eitzas. And to me, that's Talmud Torah. And I think that Talmud Torah is even more significant than my sitting here and learning from a sefer when I'm giving people eitzas and assisting. So he's not only considering that chesed, he's considering that Talmud Torah, including in Talmud Torah, Keneged Kulam.
Wow, that's an amazing story.
Yeah, well, Rabbi Schachter, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Shalom Aleichem, this is Ari Wasserman taking back the microphone for our wrap-up, takeaways, and lessons learned. And I'd like to start, before we get to our speakers, with 3 points that I believe all of our guests would agree to. Number one is Achdus does not mean that we need to agree. In fact, we can argue, but still respect each other. We can disagree, but we can still pull together. So that's point number one. Achdus does not mean that we need to agree together. Point number two, when we disagree, don't make it personal. Stick with the issues. Don't make it personal. As Rabbi Gottlieb said, be divided. Don't be divisive. And point number three, it's not so much what you say, but it's how you say it. Critical, even when disagreeing with people, is say it like a mensch. Be understanding. Be empathetic. It doesn't mean you have to agree, but it's not what you say, it's how you say. Let's get to Rabbi Breitowitz. Rabbi Breitowitz, he brought the pasuk in Zechariah, Vaha'emes, Vahashalom Ehavu. Emes, my view, truth. But Shalom, also, they have to love each other. They have to coexist together. That's what he told us. Emes and Shalom need to somehow coexist, but Shalom, unity, does not mean we need to compromise on our emes, on our Torah values. We should not compromise on our values. He told us that there are actually two different types of achdus. Number one, for concepts, and we're talking about somebody else. They have a concept. They have an idea that they have a mesorah for. I may disagree with it. I have an idea. I have a concept that I have my own mesorah for, but we need to acknowledge that it's a legitimate view. Even if it is somebody else's, we need to acknowledge it's legitimate, and we need to be respectful that such an opinion has a basis. Achdus does not mean required uniformity, but respected diversity. So again, that is where when the other party has concepts and ideas that have a masorah, I need to acknowledge that, and I need to be respectful even if I disagree. But on the other hand, type number two, when somebody has concepts, ideas, hashkafas that don't have a masorah and are even antithetical to Torah, we don't show respect for those concepts, ideas, those hashkafas. However, having said that, we should look for something positive in the individual who has those thoughts, who has those concepts, ideas, hashkafas, in order to have a different form of achdus. Meaning, I don't have to embrace, and I should not embrace or respect their beliefs, but I need to find something positive in the individual so we can still have a achdus relationship together. Just an important point of departure. It's interesting to note between Rav Moshe Sternbach, we quoted his book at the introduction to the show, and also with Rabbi Breitowitz. So there is a difference. Should protest be used as a method of standing up against what is wrong? Rav Sternbach says he has a mesorah from his Rebbe that protests are important. When there's a chilul Hashem, we need to protest and stand up. But Rabbi Breitowitz is not a fan of protests, and that's based on Rav Chaim Kanievsky and Rav Steinman's approaches. And here is a clip of Rabbi Breitowitz that we have not heard yet in this regard. I asked him how to think about protesters, and I was asking about right-wing protesters. It could be Peleg stopping highways, and it could be left-wing. It doesn't matter. It's all the same. How should we think about when people are protesting, stopping the highways, even inconveniencing people significantly, making them wait for hours as the protests go on? And this was Rabbi Breitowitz's response.
If I, as an American, I'm so tolerant and you know, forgiving, I don't get upset, I don't do these things, is it because I'm a Ohev Shalom, or is it because I don't care as much? So I can look at kind of even these Kanaim, and I can say, I don't think they're doing the right thing. I think it's very wrong. But I could say, but you know, there's a certain Mila in their commitments, in their passion, in the fact that this upsets them and that infuriates them. And maybe there's something wrong with me that I don't feel that same sense of outrage. So outrage is a good thing, but it's a powerful weapon. It's like nuclear energy. You got to know when to use it. Otherwise, it gets destructive. So in many, many ways, that passion can be a good thing. You know, that's why I sometimes think the ideal Ben Torah would be kind of the combination of American tolerance and mutual respect with Israeli kanos and zealousness and a sense of passion. And if you can combine those two midos, that would be a very, very good thing. Indeed, that's the hanhaga of our gedolim, I think, combined those two things.
In fact, that is classic Rabbi Breitowitz. He's such an Ohev Yisrael. Even when you vehemently disagree with someone, still look for something positive in that person. In Parshas Metzora, related to Dvar Torah, it says as follows, that the Metzora, on the day that he becomes Tachor, it's Perek Yudal at Pasuk Beis, Vayikra, Perek Yudal at Pasuk Beis, B'yom Ta'arasov, Buhuvel HaKoin, that he's literally brought to the coin. The Sifsei coin says as follows, truth be told, that the coin would also go out and greet the Metzora. The Metzora's out of town, he's out of the camp, he has to be secluded away from people, but nonetheless, the Kohen will also go out, he has to go out of the camp, go out in order to meet with that Mitzorah. What's the concept here? To show him kavod. What does that mean, to show him kavod? To show kavod to the Mitzorah, who was a lowlife, somebody who was arrogant, somebody who spoke Lashon Hara, somebody who was stingy, somebody who did one of the sins enumerated by Chazal that caused tzoras. Truth be told, says the Sif Seikoin, yes, we are not going to put it into conventional terms. We're not going to totally cancel this Mitzorah, although we have certainly showed him a bit of a disgrace or a big disgrace. We've sent him out of the camp. You got to go out. You can't be with people. But nonetheless, we also have to show him that we value him. We have to show him kavod. And says the Sif Seikoin, this is a very important lesson. We're punishing this person. He did some terrible sin, and that's why he has the Torah. But even when we are punishing somebody, it cannot be that we are rejecting him, canceling him totally, but rather, as Chazal tell us, lo'olam te'esh smol dolchav yamin mikareves. The left hand should be, the weaker hand should be pushing somebody away, but the right hand has to bring him closer to us. In other words, even when we're punishing somebody, we also have to show them kavod. And isn't an example of that? Parshas Baalosha, Miriam Anevia spoke Lashon Hara about her beloved brother Moshe, and nonetheless, despite the fact that she spoke Lashon Hara, had tzoras, but Ba'am Lo Nasa, the Am, Klal Yisrael waited, they were ready to go, they're in the desert, they want to travel, but they waited till Miriam had a refuah shalema, the Anan Yaakovud waited there, the Shechina waited there, because we have to, despite the fact that Miriam sinned, she had tzoras, she did the terrible sin of speaking Lashon Hara about Moshe Rabbeinu, about Weevil. Nonetheless, let's show kavod. So that is very relevant for our topic, and I think very much aligned with Rabbi Breitowitz's philosophy. Somebody may have sinned. Somebody may have wrong hashkafas, terrible hashkafas. Nonetheless, we need to show them kavod. Moving forward to Rabbi Moshe Hauer, he told us two critical principles. Number one, the Torah is immutable. The Torah doesn't change, and we are not going to be flexible on that. But number two also, Yisrael, afa pi shechata, Yisrael, who, even though this person in front of me, he is a sinner, nonetheless, we still have to acknowledge, we have to realize, and we have to feel that he is still a Jew, once a Jew, always a Jew, and treat him accordingly. And he told us that our commitment to one another is absolutely critical and paramount. And we need to find ways to come maturely to the table when serious issues arrive and work through them by understanding the other side, even if you disagree. And we have to act just like spouses, just like family members who need to work through issues. We have to work through those issues, difficult, real issues, with other Jews. Moving forward to Rabbi David Gottlieb, he gave us three strategies in dealing with others you don't agree with and you're not going to agree with. Number one, have humility. Have respect for alternative views, even when you are 100% sticking with your own view. It doesn't matter. Still have respect for alternative views. Number two, be dan the kaf's hus that the other person has good intentions. Don't assume you know their intentions. Don't assume they are negative because you don't really know. You have to assume that they are coming from a good place. And number three, understand that we are dealing with family and accordingly. And this is the quote, a very powerful quote from Rabbi Gottlieb. The relationship is more important than the issue. Then we spoke with Yoni Alon. Yoni is a non-observant, single in his 30s from Tel Aviv, politically on the left, but nonetheless, we discussed how Jews can get along with each other, and as an example, he told us about his politically right-wing, very observant army mate who goes to mikveh each and every day, and he talked about their relationship, their positive relationship, but having said that, 2 points. Number one, avoid discussing politics and other topics which will cause tension, and number two, have mutual respect, even when you have very different lifestyles. It's very interesting to hear the same thing Yoni Alon told us as the Rabbanim told us, have mutual respect. And then we heard, in the end of the day, Rabbi Shai Schachter, who told us that Achtus requires two things. Number one, we need to show up. We need to do something. And number two, we need to show we care. Ideally, find individuals and connect with them. And also, we heard the mind-boggling stories of Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Herschel Schachter showing Achtus even to those who denigrated them. Those were unbelievable stories. And last point from Rabbi Shai Schachter, we need to have confidence that even each of us, as an individual, I'm only one person, we can have an impact. We can have a significant impact, especially on the individuals that we reach out to. Just to close today's show with the fort, it relates to our topic and also to Pesach. There is a phrase, a quote from the Gemara Psachim talking about the prohibition of having chametz bal yirah, bal yematzeh. The Gemara says as follows, shalcha yataro, and literally you cannot see your own, you can't see your own chametz, aval ataro shel acherim shel gavoah, however other people's, I'm not going to violate the prohibition of bal yirah, bal yematzeh, and shel gavoah, shel acherim on the one hand, I don't violate it, somebody else's, vishel gavoah, it's of hektish, it's owned by the base of mikdash, I also won't violate the prohibition, the bal yirah, bal yematzeh. And the drash vayun says as follows. He applies this. This isn't the pshat, but this is the drash on it. This applies to seeing character flaws in ourselves and others, seeing blemishes in ourselves and others, that he says that we don't see our own character flaws, but we do see the character flaws very easily in others, and not only others, but especially the leaders, the rabbanim that we have, very easily, easy to see the blemishes of others. And he applies our phrase that we just said before as follows, with chametz representing the Yetzirah, which representing deficiency, representing character traits, character flaws as follows. A person, shalcha yataroa, you don't see your own character flaws. You don't see your own chametz. However, it's very easy. Avalat aroa shel acherim. You certainly see character flaws, deficiencies in others, and especially v'shel gavoah, and especially those who are the leaders of the generation. Obviously, a very important lesson. We need to get better at seeing our own chametz because nobody is perfect, and also we need to be accepting of others' chametz. We need to have respect for others, even if they have the chametz. But ideally, we shouldn't see it so much. But even if they have the chametz, we need to be accepting of that chametz and not judgmental over it. People should have a wonderful Pesach HaKasher V'Sameach. And on behalf of Headlines, we look forward to seeing you after Pesach.